Chairperson, Honorable September.
I nominate Honorable Kurano to be the acting chairperson in the absence of the chair from now until evermore.
I will second.
The apology, the nominee has been seconded by Honorable Van Dalen. Honorable Koronov, may we proceed with the meeting?
Thank you, Honorable Members, and for the confidence bestowed. A word of welcome to everybody to this important annual report hearing of Infraco. I'm going to firstly to ask members just to introduce themselves. Thereafter, I'm going to ask Infraco to introduce your delegation, and thereafter the other guests, including the Department of Enterprises. Members, as you know, my name is Gerard Koornhof, a member of the committee.
I'm Ms. September, I'm also a member of this committee. I am Gloria Pullman, a member of the committee.
Good morning, my name is Chris Hololo, I'm a member of this committee. Thank you.
Good morning, my name is Aubrey Mokwena, member of the Patrol Committee.
Morning, my name is Rose Sondo, member of the committee.
Yes, my name is Peter Van Dalen, I'm also a member of this committee.
Sam Manduwa from TPE.
Your mic was not on, just repeat.
Dumi Matilisa from TPE.
If I can just introduce the members of our Broadband Infraco. First, the new chair, Manda Norwell. Sitting to the right of me, Ramasela Mohole, who is the CFO, and Tommy Ntembu, sitting at the bottom of the table, is our media liaison, or responsible for media liaison. I'm the acting CEO, Andrew Shaw.
My name is Anthony Kamongoma. From the Department of Public Enterprises.
Matia Timoholo, Public Enterprises.
Chris Foley, the DDG for Energy and Broadband at Public Enterprises.
Rebecca Murdoch from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Thank you, members. Thank you, everybody. And no, can I introduce Mr. Nana on behalf of himself, or would you? Mr. Nana, member of the committee. Thank you. Again, if you look at the program this morning, we're going to have first the briefing by Infraco on its annual report. Until 11:15. So I'm appealing to Infraco if you can maybe try to finish your presentation within half an hour, 30 minutes. It'll be great. And thereafter we can have an interaction, question-answer session by members to yourselves. And thereafter the Department of Public Enterprises will be given the opportunity to make a remark or concluding remarks. And then we will wrap it up. And hopefully we'll finish by 11:15, if it's okay with you. Can we agree on that? Thank you. A special word of welcome to the acting CEO, Mr. Andrew Shaw, and your delegation. We've studied your annual report, and I must say, right from the outside, it is not the best annual report that I've seen in Parliament since I've been elected to Parliament. So the interaction may be robust, with yourselves, because we have an annual report before us, but we also want to acknowledge that you are, after this submission of this report, you came in as an acting CEO, and also you have a new chairperson. And many of the issues we're going to discuss today, you didn't create. So against that background, we're going to interact with you to see how we can take broadband InfraCo forward, how we can assist, and how we can build this very important state-owned company. So it's against this background that we will now hand over to you to make your presentation.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for the opportunity to present. As you've indicated, Broadband InfraCo has had quite a challenged history. Just for people to take you back a little, Broadband InfraCo is a startup in the telecom sector. It was begun initially under the banner of Eskom. It shares Eskom and Transnet fiber assets and transmission assets, and it provides long-distance fiber optic connectivity. Initially, it was brought in as a competitor to Telkom. It has had a profound impact in the market, but it is still challenged by the fact that there have been ongoing losses, and it is expected that those would continue for a few years before the company is turned around. I think that was always the intention of Broadband InfraCo. The reason for the rationale for ownership in state hands is to impact on the telecoms industry in a way which, first of all, serviced underserviced areas, but also brought down broadband prices, and we have seen some of that going forward. I was brought in as a acting CEO from the 1st of April, so essentially was responsible for wrapping up or assisting to wrap up, together with the new CFO, Ramasela Moholi, assisting to wrap up the audit for the previous financial year. So the previous financial year, or the year under review, was not a time frame that we were there. We picked up a number of challenges. There's quite significant governance failings within Broadband InfraCo, which we've had to address. And there's also the challenge of creating a sustainable company. And we will talk to that a little bit in this presentation so that we don't just reflect on the previous year's financials, but given that's nearly going on 8 months prior to today, we would like to give you a sense of what we've been able to achieve in the time that we've been there. In making some success of turning the company around. There is still some road to go, but at least we can give you some sense of what we've been able to do. So just at a glance, I'll focus on the previous financial year. Then we'll have a look at some performance overview, particularly financial, and I'll ask Ramasela to deal with that part of the organization. Then I'll address some focus areas, which is how we've changed our business focus in order to become more sustainable going forward. And then the last area is to actions to address governance shortcomings that have been identified by various audit findings at Broadband InfraCo. In respect of 2010-2011, one must understand that this company had changed or grown from roughly 40 employees to roughly 156 or so. It was launched to the broader telecoms market in November 2010. So effectively, we only had a commercial product to release sometime in the last financial year. We have opened 5 new open access points in KZN, the Western Cape and Gauteng. We have a number of pilots, a number of customers that are piloting services across our network, and that continues to grow. So a big focus for us is on revenue growth, as you will see going forward. We also have quite a substantial fiber optic footprint that nobody besides Telkom is really able to provide. So we have 13,000 kilometers of fiber optics across the country running on power lines or next to railway lines. In some instances, we've had to interconnect these with our own fiber that runs next to roads, etc. At an operational level, we've established in-house maintenance operations, and we take on our biggest key customers' operations and maintenance activities from January next year. We have international connectivity through our participation in the WAX cable. We're at 11%, or a tier one contributor to that project. And we've grown the staff complement over this period of time, or the previous management had grown the staff complement quite substantially. I'm not going to talk to the financial achievements because I think Ramasela will give quite a lot of detail in respect to those, and I would rather get through the presentation a little bit faster, if that is okay with you, Chair. If I can hand over to Ramasela, who will take us through the performance overview and the financial overview, and also give us a sense of where the company is heading over the last 6 months?
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Andrew and the Chair. The presentation that I will be handling will be split in two sections, an overview of the previous financial year, as well as what we've been doing in the next the last 6 months. Revenue, as reported in the annual report, we've dropped revenue by 3%. The gross revenue went up by 23% before straight lining of the turnover based on the contract that we've entered into. Cost of sales went up by 11%, and the main driver of the cost of sale is our outsource fee, which I'll talk about later. The managed service cost and the depreciation charge in that. EBITDA went up significantly by 868%, and the main driver, as I will indicate in the next slide, will be the outsource service and the managed service cost. Operating expenses as well went up by 41%, and we made a loss of about 207 million. Versus the 28 million in the previous year. But the main contributor of us making a loss is that in 2010, Infraco was not launched as yet, so there were little operations that was taking place. In 2011, Infraco was launched in November 2010. In that financial year, then we think had a lot of expenditure. We started operating as a business. The major cost that Infraco has incurred in the previous year, or our main driver, is outsourced fee. This is the fee that we paid to a service provider to manage our network. We're paying it to different entities via Newtel, but we're paying it for Eskom and TFR. The managed service cost, we also have a network operating center in the building that is being managed by a service provider. That is another driver that we're working on. We'll just indicate the plans going forward on those two fees, outsource and managed service cost. Depreciation and amortization is purely a factor of our capital expenditure. As we're growing, we will be seeing an increase in that number. That is the number that we'd like to see that will indicate the capital outlay that we're putting. In the last financial year, Infraco created 89 permanent jobs, which resulted in 44% personnel cost increase. Our cash flow position at the beginning of the financial year was 852 million. And we closed the year with 529. During the year, we utilized only 4.5 million from funding, and we had finance income because of the bank balance that we had of about 46.33%. And finance cost, the debt, 15.18, was mainly due to the foreign exchange transaction that we entered into. We made a loss, a realized one of 15.18. Capital outlay that we've spent put on our, it was 536. This was for the infrastructure development that we engage in. We had recapitalization by both our shareholders, IDC and DPE, of 187 million that they granted to us last year, closing the year at 529 million. The activity for the last 6 months, these are unaudited numbers. This is where we're starting to say we need to drive down costs, we need to grow our revenue. Our budget and target that we've got is to grow our revenues compared to last year by 18%. Year to date, we've managed to grow our revenue. We beat our budget by 11.2 million. So we are on track to achieve the target set for ourselves. We're aggressively working on growing that top line. Operating expense is one area that we see. This is the area that we should be saving costs. For the last 6 months, we saved about 4%, and we have started with initiative to save costs. So we see that percentage increasing of savings. Finance income, because of the capital outlay and the bank balance that we still have, we made a profit of about, or finance income of about 20 million. Year to date, we made a loss of 50 million as compared to 96 million that we budgeted for. So because of the growth in revenue as well as the operating expenses, we managed to achieve better results by 48%. So this slide actually talks about what we've done. In the next few weeks, we will be issuing out a request for proposal for funding. So we'll be going to financial institutions requesting funding for our capital outlay. For the next financial year, we're looking at spending 700 million on our network, both expansion and maintenance. We'll be looking at organizations like IDC, DBSA, as well as commercial banks to fund that program. Thank you.
Joshua Maseda. If I can just take you through some of the focus areas. We've identified three primary focus areas for the company moving forward. I think Ramasela has given you a good sense from the financial perspective of our ability to at least beat our budget for the first 6 months of this financial year. We're focusing very strongly on building a core relationship with customers and building that revenue line. Also focusing on enhancing our capital rollout program, because the only way for us to generate revenue going forward is to invest behind what customers in the market require. And these are the big telecom players, as well as some of the smaller, very fast-growing ISPs. From a service perspective, we expand the network, we're improving service levels, but we're doing so in collaboration with customers, as opposed to what we had done in the past. We have a number of pilot projects. We have a pilot project in KZN, together with Centec, to service underserviced areas. We're rolling that out in the first half of the next calendar year. We also have a very strong rollout program to service the SADC region. We have a strong interest from SADC players to connect into our network and then onwards into the East and West Coast cables. And we have a number of focus areas in respect of internal processes. I will share some of these with you, but one of the biggest challenges we've had is that the organization in the previous financial year was not PFMA compliant in a number of respects. It was not PFMA compliant from a procurement perspective, from a capital program rollout perspective, from an HR and from a finance perspective. So we've put in place, and we are in the process of putting in place, a number of governance processes, policies and procedures to align ourselves with the requirement to meet the PFMA. We have a continued focus on human capital development. Because we are a high technology industry, we need to attract the best. There's a shortage of skills within the sector, and a big focus for us, particularly through this difficult time, has been to avoid losing the skills that we have within the company and trying to attract new skills into the company. I will talk to this a little because we have completely changed the executive structure of the company since the previous financial year. One of the other challenges is we need to strategically realign the company, and that's something I'll speak to in the next slide. In February of this year, a corporate plan was presented to the shareholders which was not able to demonstrate sustainability of InfraCo over a 10-year time frame. We were requested to review this, and we reviewed this and put in place a new corporate plan, which the shareholder approved at the end of June. The new corporate plan focuses on expanding our value proposition and aligning that much more closely to customer requirements. This has required that we become much more adaptive in the market. It's also required that we invest more strategically in the market going forward. So at the top of the slide, from a backbone perspective, in this area, this is really what we had focused on providing the market in the past. It's five basic services, and the market can decide, do you wish to take these services or not? We don't invest behind anybody's particular telecoms infrastructure plan. Our focus is really just to provide services to anybody who's willing to take them. What we have done is we've expanded these value propositions into the four that you see below, these four here. One of the focus areas, or the first focus area, is backhaul. This is to meet very specific objectives of the big mobile players, to be able to connect mobile operators to switching centers and to underserviced areas. We'll focus on doing this on a co-built or a paid-up basis, so we'll work very much more closely with these organizations, and we've already started this process to align our infrastructure development with the infrastructure development of the big telecom players in South Africa. The second area is expanding our metropolitan presence. Now, this is an area where we don't have infrastructure and we don't necessarily wish to build infrastructure. And what we would do is partner with metro fiber networks that are in place in order to expand our value proposition to customers. There's a number of private sector players. There's also a number of public sector players. Some of the big metropolitan areas have quite substantial fiber, eThekwini being one of them, Johannesburg being another one. The third of the new value propositions is to expand our African connectivity, to link much more closely into SADC, to provide them with redundancy. We are already taking pop sites to the border of every country that links to South Africa, and we have a strong interest from these countries in bringing volume of traffic which we can interconnect into the West Coast and East Coast cables. The last area is to provide engineering services. We have fairly unique access to Transnet, Freight Rail, and to Eskom powerline and rail servitudes that we can leverage in order to meet the needs of fiber optic rollout by other players. And what we would like to do is to do this strategically in such a way that we can maximize our revenue returns and also expand our network particularly in underserviced areas. So this really represents our new business plan for this financial year. We've put it in place. We've started to roll it out. We've had an organizational restructuring which aligns to this business plan with a marketing focus on meeting each of these value propositions and with a capital investment program that Ramasela mentioned with $700 million spending in the next financial year, which is aligned to meeting each of these value propositions as we go forward. So it expands our value proposition. It means that whilst we're loss-making for the next 4 years, we start to achieve sustainability relatively quickly. If you consider that our previous business plan was not able to demonstrate sustainability for a 10-year time frame, this new value proposition brings that forward quite quickly, and it meets both our underserviced area objectives as well as our commercial objectives within the company. This is what our network currently looks like. I won't spend a lot of time on this. The thickness of the lines demonstrates the current volume of traffic that we're moving, and the dotted blue lines indicate where we're adding additional infrastructure into our network in the next 1 to 3 years. What you will see is north of Gauteng, there's some shortage of infrastructure, and there's quite a strong requirement for new infrastructure in Limpopo province connecting up into Botswana. You'll also see that we've got a strong focus on bringing POP sites into the borders of Namibia, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Swaziland, Maseru, we've just finished here. So our focus is to strengthen our network and interconnect it more strongly. What you'll also see is that there's investment programs to take us through three independent routes into the WAX, the West Coast Cable, as well as in Mthunzini, which is the East Coast Cable. So we're really positioning ourselves much more strongly. So we have a strong drive to invest in infrastructure to position this network even better than it is positioned at the moment. And it's only in this way that we'll be able to generate the kind of revenues that we require from a commercial perspective. The POPs on our roadmap, these represent the POP sites, which are really the link points that we have into our customers' telecom space, and that we would like to be implementing very early on in the next financial year. So we're targeting to roll most of these POP sites. 5 of these are already in place, but we're targeting to roll out the balance of these within the next few months. You can see the focus is to take them to the big metropolitan areas first, and then to some of the smaller ones, and then to some smaller towns and cities. In addition to this, our rollout extends for open access POP sites to a number of areas. If you look along the in KZN, you'll see a lot of these are in underserviced areas. And the focus here is on supporting Centec in their rollout to underserviced areas, and this is our investment program for meeting that. So these are the future rollout for open access POP sites to strengthen our interconnectivity of our network and provide to the needs of our customers.
Can you explain what a POP site is?
A POP site is a point of presence. Essentially what it is a container. If you have driven around the country, you will have seen Vodacom and MTN containers, usually with a tower. We don't have towers, that's not our business, but we would have a POP site, which is a container with a security fence around it, or alternatively, we would interconnect into a data center. A data center is where a number of telco players interconnect. There's one that we interconnect in Midrand, there's another one in Alsando. These are quite high-tech facilities operated by a number of players in the sector and quite often with presence of all the big telecom players, including Telkom, MTN, Vodacom. All those big players would interconnect into these centers, these data centers. It's important to be in every data center because they would normally be in the metropolitan areas, but also to have strategically placed POP sites so that people can interconnect with those sites. So for us, this rollout is really critical for making our business plan achievable from a commercial standpoint, but also from a underserviced area standpoint. As we mentioned at the beginning, as the chair indicated, there have been a number of quite significant governance shortcomings. On coming into the organization, we realized that the shortcomings from a governance perspective were much more challenging and much more significant than we had originally anticipated. We have had ongoing internal audit activity and findings, and we've tried to address those findings as they've arisen. The first set of findings came November 2010, and they relate to specific fiber optic rollout contracts where a number of irregularities were identified. You will see in the annual report towards the end there's a table which identifies frequency and wasteful and irregular expenditure, and that really highlights some of the findings of those internal audit reports. You will also see in the annual report a qualification. The basis for that qualification is that we were not able to demonstrate that those tables were in fact the sum total of all irregular or fruitless and wasteful expenditure. We have now put in place systems to make sure that all documentation is stored, managed, that processes are followed. We have tick box processes, we have sign-off processes, we have strengthened our ERP systems to ensure that procedurally we are much more governance adhered. If I can quickly take you through these, because you will get a sense of how much activity we've had to initiate in the last 6 months to try and bring the organization back up to speed, and we're still not quite there yet. From a people perspective, we've taken disciplinary action against 6 implicated staff of irregularities. We've had dismissals. Only 1 executive member from the previous executive team remains. The other executives were dismissed or resigned. We've had a number of governance and PFMA training sessions with all levels of staff, particularly middle management, who are responsible for process adherence. We have a qualification in the 2010-2011 financial year. The previous board did not pay any bonuses to any staff as a consequence of that qualification. We brought in 4 new executive members, a chief financial officer, as you're aware, Ramasela, a chief technical officer, an executive that is solely responsible for governance, something that was not previously in the structure of the company. So this executive takes key responsibility for governance processes, for reporting to our audit and risk committee of the board, for managing and ensuring that we have compliance, and for managing the internal audit and the risk processes within the company. So that executive really is responsible for helping to assist in the turnaround from a governance perspective. We've also appointed a new head of capital of our capital investment program. We've signed performance contracts with all these executives, these new executives that have come into place, and this is in line with the corporate plan. So those value propositions that I demonstrated to you previously are the basis for the corporate plan. We've identified what are the performance metrics that we would measure the executives on to meet that corporate plan, and we've signed a performance contract with them. Now, whilst we've only done this in the last few months, we haven't been able to do it until such time as we have all the executives in place and the corporate plan in place. We'll now start a process of developing our new corporate plan, which will be based on those 5 value propositions for the forthcoming or the new financial year, which will be 2012-2013. So we try to structure these processes where we hold people accountable, we set in place accountability structures within the company. We're very clear that if the governance processes that are in the company are transgressed, we have processes of follow-up, and we hold each executive responsible for ensuring that governance processes are followed. In the previous financial year, it was very clear to us that levels of accountability were extraordinarily weak. There were situations where vast amount of documentation was just missing and not there, and that really represents one of the key reasons why the auditors were not able to provide us with an unqualified audit. We've got a document management system. We now store documents in storage sites within the building. We have a proper filing system, and we have a lock-in and a sign-in system for all documentation. We also have just signed contracts for all documentation to be stored on-site as well as off-site, so that if auditors or anybody else require documentation for audit purposes, we're able to track it internally. If it's missing internally, we have access to external documentation. We've developed a completely new supply chain management policy. One of the focus areas of some of the qualification and one of the challenges that we've had in the company is procurement. It's often in state-owned entities represents one of the challenging areas. We've set in place a new policy, and we'll start rolling that out within the next few months so that we've completely upturned the policy and procedures for this area. We're focusing on appropriate planning around procurement and also ensuring that we have a proper logistics system to support our procurement program going forward. A big challenge for us is that in the next financial year, we wish to double our CapEx spend, and we have to make sure that we have a procurement system and a supply chain system that can support that without any audit findings. So a big challenge for us is to have this all in place before the beginning of the financial year. We've also aligned ourselves to the Construction Industry Board. This is a requirement of state companies from an infrastructure perspective. It's taken quite a lot to get these contracts into the system. All our contracts with infrastructure providers now aligned to CRBD. Payment principles have also been implemented. Ramasela has implemented a number of governance processes to improve the way we make payments, how we sign payments off, how we log and track payments, and how we check them to ensure that we can make a payment against infrastructure that is in fact been built or has been delivered and is successfully signed off. We have contract management processes which have been strengthened further. This was a weakness in the previous financial year. And we have capital project implementation recommendations that are based on our internal audit findings. So as we've got internal audit findings, we've taken the recommendations and we've taken each recommendation and worked on an appropriate response to that recommendation. We are now going into a process where internal audit, who is Deloitte, has not been in the company for the last 6 months. We're bringing them back in to start internal audits again to see if we now comply. There are probably some areas where they will find certain weaknesses, etc., and we'll continue to address those. The first area that they're coming into is procurement. Ramasela, I don't know if there's other areas that you want to mention that we expect internal audit to come into the company.
Thank you, Andrew. Yes, they will be covering the finance section as well before the external auditors come in. So before KPMG and Auditor General come, we'll need to make sure that HR and finance is well managed.
A further weakness that was identified in the company is that there was very poor adherence to declarations of interest. People had interest in various companies that were not declared. We have now set in place a new focus for declaration of interest, which is monitored regularly so that people's declaration of interest forms are provided consistently into the company at an ESCO level and at a middle management level. We also have a process now where we identify as management whether a particular declaration of interest or the holding of somebody's shares in a company, in fact, is something that we would support. And if not, we would request that that individual no longer holds an interest or a stake in that company going forward. We've initiated a number of HR POE payment procedures to avoid the previous payments of penalties to SARS. You will see in the last financial year we paid 500,000 or half a million in penalties to SARS for late payment of POIE. We set in place a number of procedures to avoid this. We have a proper payroll claims process that is now set in motion. We didn't have that previously. Part of the rationale for some of these is that because we were a startup, some of these processes were just not put in place fast enough. We have procurement tracking and reporting tools, and we've also identified a number of internal audit findings in the IT area. So we now have effective backups, we have IT security, which has been substantially improved, and we store backups now off-site as well as on-site. From a system perspective, we are enhancing and implementing control measures in our ERP system. Enterprise risk remains one of the key focus areas for the company. We've had some reprogramming of that system to disallow certain types of transactions from occurring if they don't meet certain governance objectives. We also have an intranet system that we set up, and on that intranet system, we continually update all our policies and procedures. So any staff member within the company has complete access to the policies and procedures, whether they're in procurement, in HR, in finance. And through a training program, we're able to bring people up to speed with what is required of them in respect to procedural adherence. The new corporate plan, I have spoken to you. It was submitted towards the end of June. Towards July, we received feedback from the shareholder that they support the implementation of that corporate plan. I've indicated the value propositions, but the focus here is to turn the company around, make it sustainable, meet governance requirements within the company, reorganize the company so that it's aligned to the commercial objective, underserviced area objective, so we have a number of positions that are focused particularly on meeting our mandate in respect of underserviced areas, but also our governance requirements. So that's the reason for having a new executive position in respect of governance added to our structure. And that's where I would like to leave it. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Acting CEO, and your team for the presentation. Here you have it. It's not good news. It's not a good annual report, let's be frank. And it is summarized, as you rightly refer to, page 86 and 87. is really, if you look at note 27 to the financial statements, on the left-hand column of the two pages, is really talking to the weaknesses that existed within InfraCo. But at least you've also taken some steps to put it right. So with the bad news, I think, members, before I open it up for questions, we're very grateful for the new leadership and the actions that you've already taken to put right things that you haven't inherited, you have inherited that you did not create, and especially to strategically realign InfraCo, and for the to acknowledge at least the shortfalls, and to already to put already action steps in place to turn the company around with a new corporate plan. Members, I'm going to ask to indicate to the committee secretary just your willingness to ask a question, and then we're going to ask InfraCo just to make notes of all the questions, and you can reply at the end, and if there are time available, I'll allow a second round of questions to go around. We start with the first three, Honorable Van Dalen, Honorable Sontu, Honorable Van Dijk.
Yes, I would like to start with a part where the director's interest, which say, well, the question I ask is, how many of the money that was stolen from InfraCo has been recovered? That is my first question. And how much of the staff members that were fired are contesting their firing on the basis that the punishment doesn't suit the crime, and we'll be back in 2 years' time with huge payouts like Mr. Gama, and is it and you can't say it's impossible because we have seen it happen, you know. And then I also want to ask these directors, do they still own interest in the company? I see in the annual report in 2010 the interest was about 100 million in 2011. It's now half to 50 million, and was there any payment to them as a, are they still profiting out of the contracts which they have from broadband? I need to know these answers. And I read in the paper that in the media about the staff morale and the fact that they have accused you of not following due labor laws to run the company, but you have a quite autocratic manner in dealing with certain issues in the company. So if you can just answer those questions for me, please.
Thank you. Honorable Sont.
Thank you very much, sir. Thanks, Dr. Shaw, for your presentation. You realize that even though the turnaround strategy that you are employing is showing signs of improvement, there's a great deal of interest in two activities that have taken place in the company. You've made four new appointments as a company. The question would be, how did you manage that? Given the fact that you've posted a loss of this magnitude, I don't even have to mention it. You've posted the loss of this magnitude, and you made these appointments. Yes, they were necessary, but how did you manage doing that? Also, there are resignations and firing that has taken place within the company for reasons given. Now, on those people who have been fired, on those people who have resigned, are there still links of some sort with company activities? I'm relating not the same question as my previous speaker, but if it was found that an executive member has got an interest and irregularly benefited, are those people still having connections with the company and the procurement process? If so, what is being done to correct that? I'm looking for the last one, Chairperson. There are a lot. There are some investigations that are not yet concluded. And in some instances, you are involving law enforcement agencies. What causes that? Is it because the people do not want to, what is this word, cooperate? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Van Dijk.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, yes, I was involved in the previous parliament, also in this committee, with the establishment of Infraco Company. And the acting CEO was also at present during all those meetings as an official of the department. So he's very well aware about Infraco Company since the establishment of that company and also as a public enterprise. Now, as the acting CEO, I just want to get information whether he can tell this committee, taking into account what was discussed at that stage and the future of the Infraco Company, whether he is satisfied with the way and the trend of development of this company since then, up to date, and whether he is positive that we are actually going somewhere with this company, and that it is not just, I will not say another, but maybe I can use the word another public enterprise who will struggle over years to come off the ground properly. And if the acting CEO is satisfied and positive that progress is acceptable, he must tell us why. And if he foresees problems and delays and problems that we should be aware of, so that we can assist, try to rectify them, or that we can assist by making proposals, or whatever the assistance may be, we must also inform us about that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable September. Followed by Honorable Borman, Mokwena, Khololo, and myself.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. The couple of questions I want to ask is along the following lines. The majority of them will be PFMA-related questions. And some of them might have to be answered by the department also. The first one is the disciplinary actions that... the first one is on the board. I might have missed it, but I do not see anything about the board's responsibilities that they have taken to all the stuff that you had to deal with. What is the board saying, and towards their fiduciary responsibility? And has any of the board members been asked to leave also? Has the board not been aware of any of this, and so on? So if you can tell us a little bit, first of all, about the board and their issue on this. The second one is the actions that you have taken. We must, of course, support the fact that you are starting to move into that direction. But the actions that you have taken against some of the staff members, dismissals and all of that, what is the nature of this action? Does it say that you have violated the Public Finance Management Act and therefore you have been, you know, called to a disciplinary hearing and has been dismissed and warned on that basis? And then also, Chair, the part that I'm worried, which is not this entity only, yet again another entity, like the others that appeared before us, is this question of governance and PFMA training. It is now 2011, they're still getting PFMA training. And maybe the department must explain to us in their oversight function, is this something that they don't pick up? And the board also, is this something that they don't pick up, that there has been no training? And if there hasn't been any training, by what rule or law did they function or operate on, so that at Parliament we can understand this thing? We must support your decision that you took, that the staff is not going to get, and probably not going to get, you can clarify that, bonuses. And lastly, I'd like to ask what the Treasury's role has been in all of this, and again, has the Treasury ever been informed about, you know, any of this going on? Because the Treasury must give permission to certain things also. And of course, where there are difficulties, what the Treasury's responsibility is in there. So, Chair, for now, if I could be answered those questions, thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Bowman.
Thank you. This rather cramped little space over here. I would like to. I also want to pick up on some of the Audit Committee and the Tender and Procurement Committee issues. First of all, perhaps, and it's a bit unfortunate that we are dealing with the report when we've come with a whole new sort of emphasis into the future, but unfortunately we do need to interrogate the report because that is what is before us. And I want to perhaps just say that we are very fortunate to have somebody acting CEO like Andrew Shaw to lead us. And perhaps next year, with all the new movement into the future and the new things put in place, we will be able to exercise a better oversight, because in a sense you've answered a lot of the questions that we actually do have relating to your governance issues. But nevertheless, let me pick up on page 28 of your report, and talking about your internal audit committee. Now, you have spoken about how you have now strengthened this, but just in reading the report, one sees people like SAU Mayor, who only attended 2 out of 5 meetings. Now, I would imagine that this is quite an important committee. And if people are not attending them, it means that there's a gap. And then I would see also T. Magaso, 0 out of 2 meetings, appointed in September and resigned in February 2011. And again, one would ask the question, you know, in appointing these people, surely it's too short a time. And they must have some idea of whether they are suitable or they're not suitable. So I think that is an issue of concern, and maybe in your going forward, this is going to be some of the issues that you are looking at, that you have looked at and you have fixed. And then the tender of procurement, you've spent quite a bit of time about that. And it was quite startling to find in the report that no meetings were convened for this, and one would then suspect that because there are no meetings that are convened, this opens up wonderful opportunities for corruption, the possibility of corruption. So that is an area of concern. Then I would like to just refer to, I don't know, my last question, the performance dashboard on page 40 and 41. And here one is aware that 7 of the 16 targets have not been achieved, and some of them are really quite significant, and one one looks, for example, at the top of the page there under strategic broadband connectivity available and access, 71% when the target was 100%. Your revenue, 412 target and 390.66 achieved. When you come down to the bottom of your page there, network infrastructure operations, maintenance and development, you've got a target of 12 hours and you achieved 20.68. Another, what I believe to be quite significant, time and cost of infrastructure development, you've got a target of 157% achieved. So if we could have some explanation about that. And then perhaps I could just ask about the ECS license. How do you see this with InfraCo going forward now? And the necessity for that license. I think there's an indication that perhaps you want to apply as a conditional license. What is your view on that going forward? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mokwena.
Thank you, Chairperson. One appreciates the report. And also the new leadership, the enthusiasm which you are evincing, and also the attempt to clean up in FACO. Ordinarily, Chairperson, I agree with you, this would have been a very difficult report. But the manner in which it has been presented, the honest manner in which it has been presented, makes it easy for us to appreciate this report, especially when one looks at the senses, the vision that is there of the leadership that is there. As parliamentarians, we're not just here to clobber state-owned companies. You know, where we see that you are inheriting the malaise and the stumbling blocks that are not of your own making, we must encourage you and make sure that you achieve your objectives. A few quick questions. Number one, did you have a direct interface with the PRC or DPE did that on your behalf? The essence of my question is the PRC, as you all know, is presenting a report very shortly to the President where there are going to be recommendations which do not know which way they want to go. So one would like you as a new baby, I think you're the youngest SOC falling under our aegis, that perhaps you'll be shortchanged in terms of making your own case to the PRC, because you don't have a very high profile, although you've got a lot of work to do because you, of the nature of your the mission and your vision. Linked to that, we have just heard of PBMR. To what extent are you being owed money by them? Because there's still a bit of money there, so that now you don't lose out completely. I'm saying so because it's quite possible that some of the things can just fall through the cracks, especially because of the maladministration of the board that has just been dissolved. Some of the people just be fired. Some of my colleagues have covered me very adequately on the question of PMA, PFMA, and the board, etc., etc. But I want to know, say this through quickly. Some people resign out of sheer convenience to escape repercussions, but still have rely on very lucrative contractual obligations. So we must not just be happy that Mr. A, Mrs. A, Mr. B, etc., etc., have left, and whereas now the person is in the back pocket, he can still produce a long-standing, irrevocable contract, which can enable that person still to benefit, even if they are outside
your corporate domain. Yes. So those quite, you should know that, especially Mr. Shaw, so that you don't have those things just being shoved on the carpet. The last two people's in universities, are you working with universities and also trying to recruit the youth to get into this new realm of fiber optics and communication? Because that's the new vista that people should actually be involved in. Finally, the digital divide between the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere, how far has that gone?
Thank you. Mr. Khololo?
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me also thank the presentation from Mr. Andrew Shaw with the team. I know that you have inherited a very unhealthy scenario at that Infraco. And yet they have been mandated with a mammoth task of ensuring connectivity to the underserviced areas in our country. I just wanted to ask one quick question, because most of the questions my colleagues here have covered me, on the alignment and collaboration with Semtech. I know that broadband, actually, Infraco is responsible for the cables, and Semtech is responsible for the signal. So you'll be working together, obviously. My quick question actually is on the McKinsey report and company. The McKinsey and company report in obtaining that ECS license, in that both of you with Semtech, you've been paired for a joint venture at an infrastructural level. On page 13 of Infraco's annual report, the company envisages to obtain an ACS license, but not for the purpose of which Infraco Act recommended earlier on. Can you maybe clarify for the need of the ECS license when this was not considered the requirement earlier on? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Fololo. Just from my side, I think you get a sense, acting CEO, of the concerns raised by members on your annual report, but also at the same time a sense of appreciation for the new leadership that you've you're bringing into the company with your new team. The independent auditor's report, a qualified opinion, is quite substantial on the compliance issues, on internal control procedures not in operation, and thirdly, on tender and procurement irregularities. And as I said earlier, if you go to your note 27 on irregular expenditure and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, you in that those two tables, really the weaknesses of Infraco is listed. My question is, in a footnote on these expenditures, the independent auditor found that it's not complete. Post the event, how close could you get to a complete picture on irregular expenditure, and secondly, on fruitless and wasteful expenditure? That's my first question. Just give us the committee an updated report on the completeness of these expenditures that we refer to. And then one of the questions that members ask already is on page 77. It's also a note, I think it's note 21, a related party transactions. And they are then the director, interest entity, your former chairperson, and members of the board. And it's, you can see there the quite substantial amounts mentioned in 2010 and 2011, and the companies they are related to. I think it relates to some of the questions, if you can just address that one as well. Over to you.
Chair and the committee, thank you very much for the questions. If it would be okay if I dealt with probably the majority, and then there's a couple that between Ramasela and myself, we I think are more financially orientated, I would ask her to pick up. And our new chair, Mana Tombo, if you wouldn't mind picking up some of the questions in respect of the board, I'll address as much as I can, but I think there may be some that you might be able to provide some input on, if that's okay. First of all, in respect of directors' interests in the company, it's difficult for me to comment on what you see in the report. Although I was a DPE at the time, I was not responsible for Broadband Infraco, and I'm not quite sure how the process of appointing directors came about at that particular point and how the issues of interests of director was addressed. What I can say is that our focus is for me as acting CEO is to deal with executive management and the managers below that. So our focus is ensuring that we have a clean process of people compiling their interests in respective entities, and then for us to actually assess them and identify whether we feel it's appropriate that somebody holds an interest in, say, a photocopy company or a computer company or whatever. We do have some of these instances. Some of them relate to very small minor entities. Some of them we do ask some questions about. So that's a process for us to really address. I don't really want to speak to the issues on the board because that's outside of my domain. How many people contest their firing or their dismissal from the company? We are still collating those people who've contested their dismissals. The process that we use is an LRA compliant process, and we use CCMA chairpersons to actually head up the hearing for each of the disciplinary charge sheets that are drawn up. So what it means is that this process is very legally compliant, and that the CCMA, who is responsible for making a call in respect of whether a process is fair or not fair, has in fact contributed through the chairing of those forums. So we follow a very rigorous process, and one of the challenges for us is also a very time-consuming process. Some of these disciplinary processes were initiated in January, February of this year and have only been concluded in the last 2 months. And that's because there's delays, etc. So we try to be as rigorous as we possibly can. We've focused, I have certainly, and I believe the new management has, focused completely on the evidence that is presented to us. We don't know any of the individuals from previous engagements, so we take the internal audit reports and we take the evidence that is presented to us, and we use that as the basis for formulating a charge sheet. Some of these charge sheets were formulated prior to my arrival at Infraco, and then we follow a CCMA process. So people can contest the finding, and they may be successful in that contestation, but we've tried to be as rigorous as possible to avoid that situation. In respect of directors and payments to directors, I think that's a normal board process. I can't really speak to those board-related issues. There's a normal process in respect of remuneration of board members. It is based on a compliance framework, and there's engagements with the shareholder in respect of how remuneration for board members is determined. The issue of staff morale and the impact on that and my role in this, look, let me be quite open about this process. I wasn't sent to do something that is entirely comfortable to do for me or for anybody else. When you have to go into a process and you already have disciplinary charge sheets drawn up against the majority of the executives, in fact, everybody bar one, as well as some managers below that, I don't expect that you would be regarded as popular. It's the nature of the beast. And unfortunately, a lot of people within the organization play to this and argue that I have perhaps been too draconian. The reality is, if I'm set up to clean up the company and I follow the process and I have charge sheets, and in every single case where we've initiated a disciplinary charge against an executive, we have through the CCMA process been able to dismiss that individual. In other words, the evidence is sufficient. So it is not as though it's an active process of trying to demoralize people. We have initiated a change management process within the organization starting 2 months ago to actually address issues of motivation, because we are very concerned that we will lose the key staff members that hold core technical skills. There's a shortage of telecom technical skills in the country. We have some very good people. We do not wish to lose them. As well as that, the morale of all staff members needs to be improved. But we can only initiate a change management process and a morale-building process once we've actually been through the disciplinary processes. So once the new executive was in place, which is probably from the beginning of October, fully in place, the new members that I indicated, we initiated the change management process. And so what we're in the process of doing now is actively building morale, actively engaging with staff members, actively bringing them up to speed and on board. Obviously, there are some people with scars and some people with hurt. There's also people outside the organization who feel that the process is unfair, and sure, they may take a number of actions to try and destabilize the company further. What we've got to do is work with staff in such a way that we can get them to align to the new future of Infraco, to align to this new business plan, to align to the requirements of the new executive management, and also to understand the importance of following correct procedures. I think we've been reasonably successful. There are still some pockets of low motivation within the company. I'm quite open to that fact. We will continue to address this problem. We have an active change management process which we've initiated now. We have people that we even have the opportunity for people to go for counseling if necessary. We have the opportunity for people to express themselves in smaller groups, through survey procedures, through various kinds of activities. We have a lot of motivation building approaches within the company. I think we will get there. We probably require a few more months of change management. The change management contract that we have in place is for about 8 to 10 months. We initially wanted to go for quite a quick change management process, and we were advised that in the context of the company process that you're in, you actually need to make sure that you have a long-standing process where you go back to members after a period of time and you test whether you actually are successful in achieving change management within the company. That process, as I indicated, was initiated on the 1st of October, and we will continue to engage with that. The activities and the four new appointments, how we were able to achieve it. I think one of the things that's important for members of the committee to understand is that Infraco was a startup company, and it was always expected to make losses for some period of time. I can guarantee you that at the end of this financial year, our objective is not to make an EBITDA positive or to be profitable. It's to be above what we have budgeted for and what the shareholders set for us as financial targets. Our new corporate plan identifies that it will take 4 to 5 years to turn the company into profitability. And that is the nature of a startup. And so one has to be very careful when you look at the profit relative to loss, that you don't make a judgment that we're making a loss, therefore we're unsuccessful. For us, if we're able to achieve the revenue targets going forward in the next financial year particularly, that will be the true measure of whether we're effective in the marketplace, because that's our ability to bring volume of telecoms traffic onto our network, and that will be quite key. In respect of the four new appointments, the important thing from my perspective and the board's perspective at that particular time was that there was a view that perhaps we hadn't interrogated the need for high-quality executives in broadband Infraco, given where this company was going, given the mandate that it had. So we initiated a process where we headhunted far and wide, and it took us many months to find the right caliber of people to bring into the company at a technical level, at a financial level, at a governance level. I'm fairly confident that the executives that we brought in are at the right level or caliber and have the right degree of experience to take the company to the next level. It's challenging. From a financial perspective, there's a lot of revenue we have to bring into the system. The governance processes are by no means completely cleaned up. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. So there's a lot on the plate of these executives. But we have managed to excite them about where Infraco can go and bring them into the company. I think many executives that came in asked us the question, should we be coming to Infraco? Does it have a future?
And we were able to demonstrate that we have a very positive business plan with a lot of interesting and exciting activities, and we have a very supportive shareholder that has a long-term vision for InfraCo. Do some of the people that have been dismissed have links into the company? Yes, we do have evidence that there are some linkages. I don't think it should be unexpected. I mean, it's a relatively small company. People will know one another. And as a consequence of that, people do have low morale. They feel scarred. They feel injured. We know that that's the case. And the best that we can do is work with that team. What I can tell you is that we've had, through our process of change management, is we've had far fewer resignations than we expected. In fact, the level of resignations from the company is roughly the same in the last 6 months as it was in the previous 6 months before we started this process, which indicates that it's not like people have wholesale resigned from the company. There are some unhappy individuals. There are also some people that we have to be very clear with. They now need to follow a different process. They need to do their work. They need to be accountable. Those issues were not addressed in the previous company, particularly accountability. A number of staff members got away with not doing their work effectively, not following procedures, but not necessarily attending to the day-to-day activities in the way that they should. We want to try and enforce a performance ethic within the company that if you perform against the objectives that are set for you and if you support your executive management in particular areas, that we will reward you as a company. That's the kind of ethic that we want to instill. I personally don't believe that ethic was there. I'd be very, if I could ask Rosella to give you her perspective of that ethic, just so that you get a different opinion from my own, I would also be appreciative, because I think Rosella is coming to the company 3.5 months or so, and she has a perspective of how a company like this should be operating, and I think she'll be able to give you quite a true perspective. Investigation is not yet concluded with law enforcement. We have a forensic investigation that was initiated right at the beginning of this process. The challenge in the forensic investigation is, first of all, they have to hear all the evidence from all the disciplinary processes before they can formulate their activities to engage with the police. They have opened a case, and they are investigating whether people received funding or payments outside of their salary, etc., and that requires the subpoenaing of bank accounts, etc. The police, the commercial crimes unit, is quite slow to address some of these issues. We're pushing Deloitte, and we want Deloitte to be able to provide us something by the end of this calendar year, just to give us some feedback as to where that process is at. That will give us an indication as to whether funds actually did go missing or that people did receive kickbacks, etc. Our view is that once we've got that, and if it shows something, we'd initiate criminal proceedings. If it doesn't, we'd actually like to move forward. We can't continually focus on the history of the company. We need to move to the new space. We're not sure whether there are such issues. We don't have evidence either way at this point. And Deloitte has not been able to yet provide us with the feedback of that forensic. The board responsibilities, I can't entirely speak to board responsibilities. I mean, what I can say is that we have an almost completely new board from my perspective, and they have come in with a great amount of enthusiasm and are very, very strongly behind both the governance cleanup as well as turning the company around. And so we've got quite a lot of board support for doing that, even in the short time that they have been there. The nature of actions taken against staff, whether they're peer for main governance orientated, yeah, they're largely peer for main governance orientated. I can just say this, the peer for main can be quite onerous, particularly for companies that are competing in a commercial frame. Most companies, if this occurred in a private company, would probably not have the level of required cleanup that we are requiring in this area. The peer for main is quite onerous. But I can also say that in some areas, governance has become an important thing with King 3, etc., even for commercial companies. In some areas of InfraCo that we have identified, it was just the absence of no governance framework at all. Whether it was PFMA compliant or Companies Act and King 3 compliant, it just didn't exist. And we know in dealing with other telecoms providers that they have quite strong governance frameworks in place. So there were shortcomings in InfraCo that went well beyond even a private company, but most of the charge sheets, etc., were drawn up on the basis of governance findings, on the basis of the PFMA. Staff not getting bonuses. I can tell you that The decision by the board not to provide staff with bonuses had a very demoralizing impact, and the staff felt in areas where of the business that were working effectively, and there are some, staff felt that why should they suffer because other people in the organization had let them down. Unfortunately, that was a decision taken by the board, which I support, given the nature of what's in the annual financials, and we will move to be able to reward staff in this current financial year. Treasury compliance, I can ask Ramasela to deal with that. We are meeting every obligation in respect of Treasury compliance. Audit committee attendance, I wasn't at Infraco at that time. I've seen the table that you referred to. I can't really comment on it. It doesn't make good reading, let us say. It is challenging that there are a number of spaces where people have not attended meetings. Tender and procurement committee, again, it does demonstrate potentially that there was a shortcoming in that committee did not meet. The targets not achieved in respect of the shareholder compact at the back of the document. Look, our engagement with the shareholder is that it would be unusual for a state-owned company to achieve every single one of those targets. Some of them are push targets, but what is clear to me in the company is that the company didn't achieve very much of the basic targets. The basic financial targets were skipped. There's a number of targets there that, from a network compliance perspective, that we are pushing very hard to try and meet within this current financial year. One of them that you mentioned is our ability to meet the restoration of faults on the network. Part of the challenge there is that we historically had a challenging contract with Neotel, where Neotel is contracting Transnet and Eskom to provide a maintenance and support framework for faults on the network. So we are some distance away from being able to address those challenges. We are contracted to Neotel. Neotel, in turn, is contracted to TFR and to Eskom, and that's historic. That will change from January as we get into a normal commercial relationship with Neotel. So we expect we will be able to put greater pressure on TFR and Eskom to be able to deal with faults much faster. And we've also got we now have our own operations and maintenance team in place. But it may still take some time to address some of these challenges. I think what I also would like to make clear to the committee is that we may still have a table of irregular expenditure going forward. There are things that come out of the woodwork. There are processes that we haven't had in place for the first 6 months. It takes some time to turn the company around, and so we still would probably, it's not like next year we're likely to have a glowing report. It's part of the turnaround process. What we are very clear that we wish to demonstrate is that we can meet the targets of our internal auditors and that we can ensure that we are not qualified. And I think we're very much on track for meeting those two requirements. ECNS license, we do raise this issue. It had been raised previously. One of the processes in our new corporate plan was to, together with an international consultant, to identify our value propositions. And they, through a set of analysis they did with us, they identified that we really should remain a wholesale player, that we should not compete in the retail. We don't have the mandate to do so. We don't have the infrastructure to do so. We don't have the retail relationships. We should focus on being a wholesale player, and we have a license for that purpose. However, there's two areas where an ICNS license with conditions would be very useful to us. One of them is to service underserviced areas. Where we're working with Centec, Centec has such a license, so that's not a constraint to us. But in other areas where we have USL requirements for pop sites in other parts of the country and we're not working with Centec, having that license with conditions would allow us to be able to take services, say, directly to clinics or schools or hospitals. So that is a requirement, a social requirement, not a commercial requirement. So it's not as though we're competing directly with MTN and Vodacom, and that was the concern at the outset of the establishment of Infraco. The additional reason that we would require an ICNS license is that part of our value propositions are to deal with international customers or customers that are based in SADC countries. Now, many of these customers don't have South African licenses, and so we would need to hold the license to enable ourselves to service their requirement. And it's a key part of expanding infrastructure into SADC, meeting the mandate of the country from an African perspective. So from our perspective, we see this as a mandate of Infraco that is broader than just being able to establish more customers. But it's also the need for us to get customers from Europe through the WAX cable that are, again, not licensed in South Africa.
a direct interface with the PLC. They have come to us and done interviews with us, and they've also asked us for a great amount of data. They seem very interested in our engagements with CENTEC, so we have fed into that process. Whether we've actively influenced that process is difficult for me to say, but we've certainly been given the opportunity to provide them with a lot of information. To what extent are we owed money? I will ask Ramaseta to deal with that. I don't actually know, to be quite frank with you. Contracts with the previous board. Look, one of the key areas of contract with the where there was some issue of whether there was a conflict of interest is in respect of transmission equipment. We are in the process of doing a tender where we would, and we have approached the shareholder in this respect, where we would like to go to a tender for multiple suppliers of transmission equipment, so that we have, geographically, we split our network up and we have different suppliers in different parts of the network. In that way, we can get the best deal. And we've identified from a technical perspective how we will do this, and we will start a process of rolling this out. Where we require Section 54 PFMA support or approval from the shareholder, we will seek to get that approval. Where we don't, we will...
Sorry, Chairperson, with due respect, the essence of my question was, are there any evergreen contracts that have been signed by some of these people who... That in progress, as I did with some of the people who are now resigned, so that we don't just sit there complacently that they've resigned, but then Infrag is expected to honor those evergreen contracts.
I would say a conditional no, and I would ask Ramaseta if she could just comment on that. But these contracts come to an end. So we are now going into a process of new contracting for transmission equipment, and that's where the majority of the contracts lie. So I don't have any knowledge of evergreen contracts in this particular area. In respect of youth and bursaries, we do have a learnership program. Our shareholder has been quite clear with us that we need to maximize the number of youth that we bring in. We bring in recently qualified individuals, many from technicons, that wish to gain telecoms experience. We expose them to our network. We give them the opportunity to be part of the company for a year. Because we've been growing so quickly, we've actually in the last year absorbed all of the learners that we had formally into the company. I don't think we'll be able to do that in this forthcoming year. We will have to selectively identify some of the better performers and take them into the company, and then we'll go into a new tranche of getting learners in for a period of years. So that's proved reasonably successful. We also do offer bursaries. We are structuring our process to be much more aligned to the needs of the company. I think in the past what we've done is we've had a carte blanche. Anybody could come for a bursary and we'll fund it. We've identified that that's not necessarily in the interest of Infraco. We're going to align these bursary programs very much to the needs of ourselves, what we need to serve the interests of the country, and then align our bursary program behind that. The digital divide between the north and the south, one thing is very clear is that Wax Cable is going to make a huge contribution to breaking that divide. Wax brings in volume capacity to South Africa and to the west coast of Africa that no other cable is able to show. We're very confident that it's going to have a huge impact. We're also confident from a South Africa perspective that the infrastructure in South Africa is building very rapidly. The one area where we identify a gap is fiber to the home or fiber to the residence or office or factory, etc. That's still a gap in the market. It's not a gap that we serve, but it's very clear that many of our customers are arguing that if that gap was filled, they'll be able to grow volume and sell more products, and we would in turn get more contracts and there'd be more volume, there'd be more space opened up. And of course, there's underserviced areas in South Africa that remain unaddressed. What's interesting, though, is that the mobile providers are increasingly penetrating that area, and I think with our assistance and with the assistance of the USLs, that penetration will grow over a period of time. Our challenge, of course, as you've seen from our financials, is that we have to be commercially sustainable and we have to service underserviced areas. It's very difficult to balance that act. Alignment, collaboration with CENTEC continues. We have a very good relationship. We would like to intensify that relationship. They want to make more use of fiber. They also have a number of sites that we would like to access, so there is the possibility for mutual benefit in that area ongoing.
the McKinsey, I think I've commented on the license requirements. In respect of page 86 and 87, I think I've commented that, yes, those tables are quite significant. It's difficult for me to judge whether we could have made those tables complete. The auditor's opinion is this. The auditor's and the reason for the qualification is that there is insufficient documentation within the company for them to identify whether that table is complete, because if they ask for certain contracts and the documentation from a procurement or a contracting perspective is provided to them, it either doesn't exist, there are some instances of that, or for the previous financial year, or it exists only in part and not sufficiently for them to make a judgment call as to whether the contract was legitimately engaged in and we received adequate value for that contract. And that's the basis for the qualification. The basis for the qualification is, in essence, is that they could not find sufficient documentation to justify that those tables were complete. And that's why we've paid so much attention to cleaning up our documentation process, our procedures, and then the ensuring that those all the documents, once those procedures have been followed, are kept in a filed way in locked filing cabinets and are stored off-site. That's why we've spent so much attention on that, to avoid the qualification that we have received in the previous financial year in this current financial year. How close could we get to a complete picture? It's difficult for me to answer. I can tell you when we came into the company, I was asked to go and look at the storeroom. The storeroom was an old office, and if there's documents lying on the floor and there was no filing, and documents went missing. We had instances of documents that were also stolen. We cannot verify exactly where some of the information went. So it's clear to me that the auditor took the right decision because they didn't have any other alternative. But documentation was a real problem in the organization. We've tried to resolve it, but I'm hoping we've covered everything from the 1st of April, realizing we only came in on the 1st of April and the company was running for those period of months. That will be an issue that the auditor will pick up in this financial year. But we've tried to track all document going back to the beginning of the financial year and ensure that it's effectively filed and documented. I think that's all that I was asked. I don't know if I could hand over to my colleague, Marcella, to pick up some of the financial issues.
Thank you very much. I'll start with the PFMA training. I think, as well, I took it for granted that, as a state owned, we should all have understanding of it, but the knowledge of PFMA at Infraco is at a shocking level, even in areas where we're supposed to be dealing with PFMA. So we will be doing PFMA training every 6 months, because another reason other than missing documentation of failure to identify PFMA or irregular expenditure and wasteful expenditure is not understanding the definition of what is irregular and wasteful expenditure. We found a lot of information like that. That is a challenge that people cannot differentiate those two or even report on them. So we will be doing the drive again. The next question was the involvement of Treasury on the lack of control with regard to Infraco. I'm not sure to what extent Treasury was involved in the past in Infraco, but I know through the Department of Energy or Department of Public Enterprise, this is where we will have our link with Treasury, because we need to submit through our executive authority to National Treasury. So all the information that we're dealing with should be going by our executive authority. That was when then the next question was PBMR. Fortunate for us, PBMR does not owe us a cent, so we do not have any debtors balance that we've got with PBMR. Issues of irregular expenditure and wasteful expenditure completeness, we're finding every time suppliers calling us for outstanding payment, and we try to go back to see information, whether that information exists or not, and we realize that the suppliers most of the time have information than we do internally, and information is not at the required standard. So we will be, as Andrew has indicated, we will still be reporting on irregular expenditure, mainly because of contractual, some, even the work that has been executed by the suppliers that
we were not aware of. So we are getting, I think, 1 week I get about 2 emails about you owe me something, and so that is the process we're going through. We might even have legal cases because of us refusing to pay, but before we will pay, we want to interrogate every supplier. We're even getting into a process of having the technical team go and verify if the work was done, because we do not have any other manner of proving that. So that causes the delay, that might cause us to incur interest, because from the supplier point of view, if it's a legitimate supplier, from supplier point of view, if we delay payment, they might charge us interest. But we rather, at this point, incur that little bit of interest, but find exactly if the work was actually executed. So this is the process that we're in now. Hopefully, I'm sure by the end of December, we should have everybody that we ever owe must have come back. We have to get to a point of closing down some books. I think that covers everything. On issues of ethics, we're also starting that every committee that we have, especially internal procurement committee, that committee should actually, and every employee of Infraco should sign the ethics and understand the ethics conduct. And we're actually finalizing a document mainly for the committees that deals with procurement, that every member of the procurement committee should have a clear understanding of things like gifts, what gifts to accept, which gifts not to accept, which interests are acceptable and which are not. Thank you.
Chair, thank you very much. Members, I think specifically Honorable Zaptaba and yourself, Chair, raised an issue around the board relating to related transactions, party transactions. We are a new board. We are hardly 1 month old. And to the extent that we have to deal with previous related matters that the previous board had, I can only give an undertaking that we will do so. But I think the department is in a better position to say to the House what is it that had happened. We haven't had an opportunity yet to be properly briefed in relation to what the previous board has done or has not done. So to that extent, I hope in the next report to this House, we will give a report what we have done. And I think that's the only remark I can make, and simply take advantage of the opportunity to say we will appreciate assistance from this committee, and we will do our best to get the company working properly.
Members, there you have it. We're running out of time. It's already 11:15, so I'm going to ask members if you have really a pressing issue, a comment or a question finally, before I'm going to make a concluding remark, hand over for closure to the CEO and the chairperson, and then ask DPE just to make a final remark. Honorable Mokwena, Honorable Vandale, Honorable September, in that order.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson.
Just very briefly.
Absolutely, absolutely. As it pleases your lordship. Two quick questions. Where is your headquarters in Franco, number one? Number two, do you have anything that can call a patent? And if so, how sacrosanct is it? How safely kept is it? Yes. So that we shouldn't far down the line discover that you've missed out all this intellectual property aspect.
Thank you. Thank you for that shortness, Honorable Vandale.
Yes, on page 86, where we look at the column, you see the expenditure identified and then accounts ratified or condoned and then remaining irregular expenditure. Now, on the bottom, they say expenditure incurred, and I'm talking about the 1.125600. The contract has subsequently been signed by the supplier, so why is that still staying not ratified or condoned? I mean, if you have irregular expenditure, you have to regulate it in some form by a decision of the board, or and it's not happening in these, especially the 150 million rand for fiber optic contracts entered into for capital projects without correct level of authorization. And why, are they still going ahead, or are you getting back that money? I mean, you need to, you are talking about documents that are gone. you need to assure this committee that this is a serious company and not your local spaza shop where you deal with half a cigarette, you know, or one cigarette at a time. This is a serious business. I mean, it's very concerning, this, you know.
Honorable September.
And mine is just to ask that the department should maybe, in their remark, answer the questions that I have put to them, and not the general remark. And then, secondly, Chair, I'm sure that in our recommendations we would put something to the new board, and thank you for the answer. But I'm pretty sure that the board can familiarize themselves now already with the PFMA. They can familiarize themselves with the King report, and the board can familiarize themselves with their own functions in the meantime. I'm pretty sure that the committee would want to have a relationship with you, but I'm sure there are some things that could be done now already to avoid what has happened. And so on the board also, I look forward if the department can also answer me on that question. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Before I hand over to you, it is really a sad state of affairs, what you've reported the other morning, and also the outstanding issues. But it's in a sense frightening what we heard historically and what is still going on. But at the same time, I think we are very encouraged with your leadership, your dedication, your commitment, really to turn InfraCo around. And therefore, I get the sense you will have the support of this entire committee in your endeavors. What worries me, and while were you presenting, we need to ask ourselves this question. And you put one question, Honorable Chief Executive Officer. No government framework existed in InfraCo. How did we let that happen? How didn't the executive not pick it up? How did the board not pick it up? How did the Department of Public Enterprises not pick it up? How did we as members of Parliament did not pick it up? Because those executive members came to us, yeah, and report last year and the years previously. So it's a frightening question that we need to ask ourselves. But we're very encouraged with your strategy, your vision, both you as the new executive management and the board. Before I hand over, let me hand over to you for final remarks, immediately followed by DPE, and then we'll close the meeting.
Okay. Honourable Makwena, our headquarters are in a very auspicious part of the country. We are against Johannesburg Golf Club. We have a very nice set of officers. You're welcome to come and visit us. in respect of documentation, Honourable van Dalen, I think the issue is that we've given you a sense of how bad things were. But maybe if I can just reiterate, just very practically, this is a very practical problem. If someone now goes through a procurement process, they establish a file, they establish a set of checklists which are printed, they tick off and they sign those checklists. If appropriate people sign those checklists, the committee processes that it has to go through the checklists are signed. Within our ERP system, payment orders are identified and logged, and that electronic information is stored. We have backup tapes. Those backup tapes are taken off-site and they're stored in a facility of somebody who holds IT backup tapes for numerous companies on contract. All paper information is scanned, taken off-site, stored electronically. Those files are in a locked cabinet. If you want to get access to that file for a purpose of doing your normal work, you go to the person who has the key. There's only one key for every facility in our building. We have storage facilities for HR files, for procurement, for contract, and for finance. You have to sign in, take the file that you need out, you register that this is the file that you took out, you use that file, you bring it back. It is possible that things can still go missing. You know, we in a commercial environment, we need to deal with things rapidly. Somebody can still take things out of those files. But those are the kinds of procedures that we put in place to try and protect the situation from having a situation where we had essentially no documentation. What Ramasela says to you is she will walk into my office with an email from a supplier that says they built something. We have no knowledge of what they built. They contracted with us. We have no contract. We have no knowledge of any previous invoice. They spoke to people who are not in the company any longer, and they want payment. Those issues we are trying to track one-on-one. We have meetings with suppliers in this coming week. We've got a meetings with a couple of very large suppliers. And our approach is to try and deal with it by identifying, was it legitimate? Send our engineering teams out. What did they put this into the ground? What is the estimated value? And then we'll try and honor those contracts. We also, where contracts were not achieved, and the issue on that patch, maybe Ramasela can just talk to, is where we have a contract with a supplier where we fail the governance process, that doesn't mean that contract is null and void. We still have a contract with that provider, so we have to honor that. And in some instances, we've taken a legal opinion about what our responsibilities are, and we'll honor those responsibilities. I'm sorry, Honorable Satema, I might have missed the question that you had mentioned. I just looked. I don't know if you did you indicate there was a question I hadn't answered that you raised previously? No? Okay.
Anybody else from your side?
Just lastly, on the condonement of irregular expenditure and regularizing them, we are in the process. We try to do that before the exodus of the old board to make sure that, because they've got information about the old contract, to make sure that everything that was irregular get condoned because it was within their level. Some of them were condoned before they left, but some were still not condoned because the matter was still under investigation, as it was highlighted before, where SEPS is involved. So in those areas, and the work has been done, and even at some of this contract payment has already been made. So it's a question of saying, if the board condoned it, do they want to make sure that if there was a criminal activity that the people were put to book? So that's the delay. We might still, at the end of the year, still have some open items that are not condoned, mainly because of the investigation of a city.
Chairperson?
Thank you very much, Chair. And just for the benefit of the committee, the new board has seriously taken the appointment into account, and we have engaged management. We have finished the induction program that we had for 2 days, and we just are about to form subcommittees, the most important one being the procurement one. As you heard from the presentation, we've identified procurement and governance being the key issues that are problematic in the company. And I can not overemphasize that we're concentrating, and we all would like to be proud of the company delivering on its mandate and making you in turn proud. So with those remarks, I thank you.
DPE?
Thanks, Chair. If I could just ask our DDG Legal and Governance to answer the Honourable September's questions and the other board questions, and then I'll just close with a final remark.
Thank you, Chair. I think on Honourable September's questions, probably I'll start with the last question so that I give a bit of a sequence in the response. The question relating to National Treasury's involvement with the department insofar as Infraco is concerned and whether they were informed. Yes, they were informed. The minister did forward a correspondence to the National Treasury and also indicating in that response the shareholder interventions that he has undertaken. And subsequent to that, there was also a board review to which the chairperson has spoken to. And that was also in light of identifying certain gaps and addressing those gaps as per the internal audit report. Now, what the department is currently doing is to prepare an induction from the shareholders' point of view, which will be undertaken and together with the company and the new board. Just to highlight also from the shareholder perspective, as the Chair said, what is it that it should be expected in terms of the PFMA, governance, and other regulatory compliance issues. And the last issue around the PFMA training, it is part of the induction, but also what we've decided to do is that also to give it a high level, because what we've through experience realized that, and I'm glad when I mentioned the issue of PBMR, is that there are certain gaps that are identified in the PFMA, but the follow-up thereon keeps on, you know, become a recurrence from the state-owned company's point of view. So our engagement with the companies as well in terms of beefing up the PFMA training, we will be strengthening that area. Thank you.
Chair, I just wanted us to reflect that a year minus 10 days ago, 355 days ago, we were, and I think some of the committee members were also at the launch of InfraCo's commercial offering to the market at 10% below market, the market pricing at the time, which was a huge celebration. And 3 days before that, we had the same session where the annual report was presented. And it is, it's been bothering us, as you say, is how did none of us pick up these irregularities and some of the shortcomings? Now, as the head of the unit looking after InfraCo from an oversight perspective, I've also looked, you know, a lot of stuff what we did was, you know, the reports that we're getting were that a lot of the policies, et cetera, were in progress. In hindsight, what we've seen is a lot of the policies, et cetera, that were in place were, because it was historically almost an ESCOM-type subsidiary, they had taken a lot of those policies from ESCOM and implemented it in InfraCo, being a much smaller company that didn't have the capacity to manage it in the same way. And a lot of gaps then materialized. But if you think from mid-November to 1 April, so it's like 4.5 or 5 months, where a lot of the stuff came to light and a lot of action then had to be taken. You know, we just want to talk about from the department side, recognizing the problems there, there was speedy action taken in terms of seconding a DDG to be appointed by the board as the acting chief executive in the form of Andrew, specifically given that you know, it would have seemed through the internal audit report, et cetera, that management and the former board were tainted. We also recognized that when the commercial offering was done in November, we had to start resourcing the department. And we're actually currently in the process of establishing a chief directorate to oversee, and it was actually at director level until recently. But obviously there are funding constraints within government for that, but we're busy working with Treasury on that. In October, given the outcome of this particular financials and the irregular expenditure, et cetera, and that we expect the board to be our agents and to look after this type of thing also, as well as us to perform oversight. The board was rotated in its entirety, also based on King governance you know, principles, et cetera, the fact that tenures had been too long, et cetera. There were two members, though, which is Mr. Mir and Mr. Mabalayo, that are, and we must remember IDC owns 26% of InfraCo, that are appointed by IDC, and they've retained those members. So the rest were all rotated, and we filled vacant positions, I think except two or one, let's see, I think it's one that we still have to fill. We've given the company focus to fill key vacancies. In the interim, when all of this happened, we actually instituted something that our other shareholder didn't agree with, but we had to do it, was a pre-notification for all transactions at a very low level, R500,000, which is, you know, it's almost ridiculous, but it was something that we had to do, to be notified of any transactions that would be undertaken at that, above that level. Going forward, we are enhancing oversight in terms of what exactly information we need in the quarterly reports, and also to engage with the company, and not just InfraCo, but the other SOC to actually engage them on the quarterly reports. As a department, we've instituted a review of the InfraCo business model. They've also done it, and they've developed a new corporate plan. Now, what we're going to do going forward is we've approved the current corporate plan, but we need to look at going forward what is the best way for this company to be sustainable and to achieve the underserviced the goals that we set for it. So we're busy engaging with them to give guidance for the next corporate plan. Now, in guiding that, also the minister's taken action with his counterpart at the Department of Communications, where there is agreement that we need to reestablish, and they have between them reestablished the Interministerial Committee on Broadband. And to give direction to the next corporate plan, really, there's four areas that have been agreed to look at. One is the collaboration between Infraco and Centec, which is the current stuff they're doing, especially the provincial side, and we talk about the fiber on the last mile there. And then the National Broadband Implementation Plan, and this talks to the ECS license. It says, what is Infraco's role without an ECS license? And the stuff that Andrew spoke to about, what are those areas where you would need an ECS license? So if you wanted to go into the rural areas to underserviced areas, can we enable that through the implementation plan without the ECS? We picked up something where the implementation plan says, just in our engagements, that maybe these underserviced area points of presence would be better served in certain places that government would like, but the license specifies certain other places. So Infraco would have to put POPs there and in, you know, so it's not efficient, so we're working on that. The question of, and this is the PRC issue, I suppose, also at the end, is the merger or possible merger between Centec and Infraco. And it's not to say they should merge, but there's a work stream also that's being set up to say, let's investigate the synergies and what would be involved should that need to be done. And then the fourth one, which is very important for us, is what is the framework of participation of Infraco in projects of national importance? Currently, if SKA or whatever puts out a tender, they tender as another company for it. But is there a strategic framework that should be put together that says this is how the state-owned company participates, that it's not just a competitor in the market because it's got a different mandate, etc.? So that's where we're going, Chair. We see still value in this company. We know that we do need to use it effectively to create the space to do the broadband access to underserviced areas. But in that, we've got to make it sustainable. And that's where the balance lies. Thanks.
Rumus, with your permission, can I summarize? And then we can close this meeting. First of all, thank you to the CEO, the CFO, and the chair of the board for your honesty and your frankness that you briefed this committee. We really appreciate, despite the difficult times you had, the difficult report that you had to present today, you were brutally frank and honest with the committee, and that is highly appreciated. Chairperson, you said in your closing remark, we want to make you proud. And this is what we also want, to be proud, to have a proud broadband Infraco company, and really to make sure that it's a national asset and that everybody can work towards building this into a and sustain it as a national asset. Thank you for your input. We want to wish you well as executive management, as the new board, and also our appreciation to all your staff members for the hard work that they've put in, very loyal work, to build this company. And we will appreciate on behalf of the committee that you convey our best wishes and thank you to the staff members that's been loyal workers of Infraco and building this company. Also, thank you so much to DPE for your guidance and your oversight role. We know you are experts in the field. You are hands-on. And with your inputs and with what you've indicated to the committee going forward, that's exciting. It's really, it makes us exciting to know there's leadership, there's a willingness, there's a capabilities to take it forward. And then CEO, for especially for you in the difficult task that you and your executive management and the board has ahead of you to build the morale of the staff. Extremely important. Without motivated staff, all these measures will not fall in place. To align a new business plan, to have a strategic realignment, and also important, this performance ethic that the CFO is also referred to. If you don't have it, you will probably have to develop it, but you need a code of conduct for your employees. So that they can strive to be better. We really want to work together with you. We as parliamentary committee are considering to, in future, next year, 2012, to have quarterly interactions with st- state-owned companies, just to have you on a quarterly basis, interact with you, monitor the progress, so that we work together. It's not you and us, it's we together. So, and secondly, you've invited us to come and visit your headquarters. Maybe we should take you up on that offer. Just go to, it's much better to be there and to talk to your employees and also to show them that we are interested in what they do and we appreciate what they do. So maybe in a program we should... No, we will pay. So that we can also interact with you in your own den and you're not coming 1,500 kilometers down to make a presentation. That's much better interaction. This is not the end of the process, it's the beginning. We will put a report together on this hearing. It will be debated in Parliament with recommendations. And the Secretary will help us, and we go forward. We wish you well. Thank you for your time and effort. This part of the meeting is closed. It's now 20 to 12, 11:40. Can we ask members at 11:45 that we can start and try to finish as soon as possible after the meet? This part is adjourned.
Thank you. will get to the board now. I must find something that was built that I can set up. Maybe I must go buy myself a coffee.
Can you move you one down so we've got Willem to move on?
No, I don't have to come.
Members, can we settle? First of all, welcome to this second part of this session. While you, Alex was setting it up, that's fine. It's now 11:45. We're going to try to finish as soon as possible, but hopefully before 1:30, if we can set a target time, depending on how many questions the members wants to ask. But it's fine. Can while they're setting up the system, can we ask the members to introduce themselves? On behalf of the committee, our chairperson was hospitalized yesterday, so he's not well. His apology to yourself for not being present, and I was asked to chair the meeting in his place. My name is Gerard Koornhof, and I'm a member of this committee.
I'm the secretary of the committee.
September.
I'm Gloria Borman, member of the committee.
Good morning. My name is Chris Khololo. I'm a member of this committee.
My name is Aubrey Mugwena, member of the Patrol Committee.
I'm Rose Santo, member of the committee. My name is Peter van Dalen. I'm also a member of this committee.
My name is Makhosi Nkosi, head of communication at DPE.
Dumi from DPE as well.
Just use your mic.
My name is Nozuko. I'm from Alexco.
My name is Anthony Kamongoma from the Department of Public Enterprises.
Volunteer Hart, PSJV.
Roger Paul, Non-Executive Director, Alexco.
Reginald Mizariri, Chairperson of Alexco.
Bernal Hartman, Acting CEO, Alexco.
Rebecca Murdoch from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Sam Madwan from DPE.
Thank you. Now we know who's in the room. You're most welcome.
Chair, we also have Brenda Watson in the back, who is part of the Alexco delegation.
Thank you. She could have introduced herself. Thank you. Can I express on behalf of the committee a word of welcome to this acting CEO, the chairperson, and your delegation? We're really looking forward to interact with you on your annual report. For us, this is a highlight every year to have you before us, and I hope similarly it is a highlight in your calendar to come and report to Parliament about your latest annual report. After we finish with this meeting, we will put the report to Parliament with recommendations. It will be adopted and debated in Parliament, and those recommendations will go to the shareholder. So, and that will start the process to see how we build and carry forward. Can we ask members just to switch off their cell phones, please? If it's on silent and next to the mic, it still rings. So we've studied your annual report. We've received your slides. So we're going to ask you, Chairperson and Acting CEO, to be brief as possible with your presentation. We've noted your improved performance for the last financial year that is under discussion here. We've noted the issue that the PSJV has been established. Also that the joint board has been established. We also note in your report the challenges that you face. It's in your annual report. And members will engage you on that one. So without further ado and to save time, I'm handing over to you to lead the process and to make your presentation.
Thank you very much, Eamon. We are also very grateful for the opportunity always to come in and engage with members in terms of where Alexco is sitting and the progress that we are making and some of the challenges that we're facing. We do find ourselves quite topical these days with, I guess, aspects of the private nationalization debate being around. But I think we see our mandate very much as making sure that we implement and make sure that the PSJV is successful. And as we go forward now with that PSJV having been established, now in a position where we really make sure that that is implemented properly and we start to see benefits both for the community as well as for Alexco. So as one of the key things, we do see that as a key issue for us going forward. One of the things that has happened, though, is that with the establishment of the PSJV on 7 April of this year, effectively Alexco finds itself as an entity that is in a startup phase. As a consequence of the deed of settlement provisions that we picked up, one of the key things that we carry at this point in time is a large liability of 256 million rand in terms of the environmental rehabilitation liability. As part of our history, in we also find ourselves with 58 million rand that relates to post-retirement medical aid, the bulk of which relates to retired and former employees of Alexco, although we do have 33 current employees who are also part of that 58 million rand. Alexco finds itself in the position where, having effectively handed over its operating activities and its core business to the PSJV, we are now in a position where Alexco as such is effectively a shell that has two activities. One is that we hold an interest, being a 51% interest in the pooling and sharing joint venture, and the second one, we are a standalone entity that has obligations that must be met and fulfilled in some manner in order for us, firstly, to remain and be viable and solvent in order to be a party as required in terms of the deed of settlement in the PSJV, and secondly, for us to then look at how do we evolve and now start to become a role player in terms of the mandate that is given to us to participate in the new growth path in terms of job creation, regional development, etc., as part of that further mandate. So that is what we face as a board going forward. With that in mind, the Alexco board reviewed and came up with a strategy that effectively, for us to be able to execute that mandate, firstly, we need to be recapitalized to be able to meet the historical obligations that we had. Secondly, we need to then engage and pursue new opportunities outside of the Alexander Bay area for us to create a sustainable base that enables us to fulfill the second part of that mandate. And that really is the bulk of what we will be looking to as we go along in terms of our future outlook. With that, we have already engaged and started looking at quite a number of those opportunities. We are at the stage right now where we are busy finalizing our medium-term expenditure framework application to address the very things that we have indicated, and we are confident that with our shareholder present, we are in a position where that will be addressed. Obviously, we understand that there are also constraints within the broader fiscus, but we are engaged vigorously with our shareholder department to look at how we can optimally do that. Some of the achievements that I think I would just like to highlight yet again is in June of this year, we managed to achieve 2,000 fatality-free shifts within our organization, and that now gives us a period of about 4 or 5 years of unbroken productivity where we've had no fatalities on the mine. So having come from a place where we historically experience some fatalities, especially with the work that we do with our marine side where our divers work often under dangerous conditions, our health and safety record improved materially, and that is something that we are very proud of as an achievement as we go forward. And we believe that it's a legacy that we leave and now leave in the hands of the pooling and sharing joint venture to continue. And I believe that with the composition that we have, both in terms of representatives of the Alexco members on the PSJV board, as well as the parties that we have been engaging with and working with from the community, we have a strong team that will be able to carry that legacy forward at the Alexander Bay premises. We have a remaining obligation in terms of concluding and fulfilling the township development that is part one of the last legs of us fulfilling our deed of settlement obligations. We are confident in terms of the progress that we have made so far. The bulk of the contracts that need to be in place will all be concluded by December of this year. There's one remaining contract that is to do with the sewerage and water works that still needs to be completed. We have put that out to tender, and we have recently appointed the contractor that will be undertaking that last phase that is required for us to fulfill that last condition. And we, with the program that we have in mind, believe that by June of next year, we will be in a position to hand over the township to the Richtersveld municipality. As part of assisting the community and the municipality with that process, we are also busy appointing a project manager who will make sure that all the statutory provisions that need to be in place, as well as the infrastructure that needs to be in place to properly manage that handover and the subsequent process once the municipality is in charge, is in place. So we believe that we are quite advanced in terms of fulfilling the obligations that we have in terms of the deed of settlement. I think those are the key highlights that I would like to touch on at this point in time. Other issues we can address in open question. But before we move on, I'd like to call upon our acting CEO to go straight to the financials so that we can just run through some of the highlights of the numbers as such, and then we can get into the question and answer session. Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity. I take you to your slides on page 13. If you have two slides on a page, starting with the heading annual financial statements. In general, the annual financial statements were approved by the board for the financial year 31 March 2011. An unqualified audit opinion was issued by PwC. And the signed annual financial statements were submitted to National Treasury and the Department of Public Enterprises before 31 July 2011, as required by the DFMA Act. Looking at the financial position of Alexco, and I'll take you to your annual reports on page 56, if you have that with you. Looking at the non-current and current assets, we had property, plant and equipment that increased from 22.9 million to a total of to a total of 26.7 million during the year. Capex to the value of 5.6 million was purchased, with the rest being depreciation to the amount of 2 million for the year. Then we have cash held in a rehabilitation trust, that increased to a total of 36.9 million. The cash in that trust is held to address the historical environmental liability of the 256 million that the chairman mentioned a few minutes ago. The inventory included on the balance sheet increased materially with a value of 25.2 million, and the main reason for that was the inventory and diamonds that we held in stock on hand during the 31 of March 2011. Then we also had increased in cash reserves to the amount of 19.5 million. The main reason for this was government grants received to the value of 36 million. And for the township establishment, there was also the final transfer of money transferred to Alexco, and also cash generated through operations during the year to the value of 12 million. And looking at the non-current asset held for sale, these are assets that will be transferred to the community upon completion of the township establishment. Currently, we're looking at June 2012 next year for the completion of the establishment. looking at the bottom of the balance sheet at our liabilities. As mentioned, we have the post-retirement medical aid liability that reduced materially from a 90.1 million in 2010 down to 58 million for the 2011 financial year. The first of five settlement payments was done in December to the value of 17.4 million, and the balance of that decrease presents the actuarial gain due to the new fixed terms of the post-retirement medical aid settlement with Momentum. The other material liability on our balance sheet is the environmental rehabilitation liability. That remained unchanged on 256 million for the year, and equals the present value of the estimated cost to rehabilitate the environmental disturbances at year end. Then looking at the trade and other payables, it consisted mainly of government grants to the value of just below 320 million, a VAT component of almost 11 million, and other operational trade payables to the value of 35 million. The reason for the 35 million was the provision we made for contractors on year end due to the stock on hand. Looking at the financial performance of Alex Corp, the income statement, on page 57 of your annual reports, if you need to see more detail. The diamond sales for the year equaled almost 196 million for the year compared to the previous year's 164 million. There was an increase of 20% in production, and was due to, was because of the increase in carat production from 37,000 carats compared to a budgeted production of 31,000 carats. The positive production results, along with the well-managed operational costs, resulted in an operating profit of 11.3 million for the year, compared to the 10 million loss for the same operating profit in the previous year. And as mentioned, this is the first time since 2006 that Alexco managed to produce an operating profit. Going down on the income statement, you'll note that the net operating profit improved significantly from 27 million in the previous financial year to a profit of almost 77 million in 2011. And the improvement was mainly because of non-cash movements in the statement of comprehensive income relating to the recognition of compensation received for mineral rights that Alex Corp transferred to the Richtersveld mining community to the value of 41.2 million back in 2008, and the adjustment in the post-retirement medical aid to the value of almost 14 million for the year. Looking at the bottom half of profit, profit for the year also increased with the same significant amount to 84.2 million for the year. That's compared to 36 million in the previous year. Alex also managed to accumulate interest on the cash and investments of recognized banking institutions to the amount of 7.5 million. Just for noting that interest received on government funded reserves does not reflect, as these cash items are restricted to specified projects within Alex Corp and then obviously capitalized within their loan accounts and bank balances. Then the discontinued operations of Alex Corp incurred a small loss of 150,000 for the year. These operations included the guest house, town maintenance, the fuel station, the airport, and the hospital. Only the operations of the guest house and the fuel station will be continuing in 2012 under the control of the PSJV. And quickly looking at the cash flows for Alex Corp. The cash flows from operating activities resulted in an inflow of cash of 19.2 million compared to the previous year's 14 million. This was mainly due to increased production of diamonds, which resulted in increased sales. Strict cost-cutting strategies also assisted with this turnaround. Cash flow from investing activities reflected an outflow of 5.6 million, and that was due to capex expenditure in the previous or the 2011 financial year. And looking at the financing activities in cash, Alex Corp also received the 36 million, the last tranche of Township Establishment funds and transferred to Alex Corp for the Township Establishment project. The total interest to the amount of 19.3 was earned on these funds, and 45 million was utilized towards its respective projects. 42 million of that 45 was directly contributable to the Township Establishment project. Alex Corp's own cash reserves increased during the year with an inflow of 12 million for the year compared to an outflow of cash of 1.1 for the previous year. And again, the improvement was because of the fact that more cash was generated through diamond sales and better management of costs. Just in short, then the conclusion of the financials, revenue was up by 20%, gross operating profit of 11.3 for the year, profit for the year up by 133%. Alex also improved its net asset value position to amount of 17 million compared to the previous year's loss of 67 million. Alexco's own operational cash increased with 12 million for the year. Capital expenditure increased by 24%, and the total cash and cash equivalents increased by 5%. That's all the financials.
Thank you, Chairman. That concludes our presentation for now.
It was with speed. Thank you so much. Anybody else who wants to make a contribution on your side? On your delegation? No. Okay.
Not at this time.
Can you indicate to Honorable Bowman, Honorable Colono, Honorable Mokwena, Honorable Sontu, Honorable Van Dalen, and myself?
Thank you for that very brief presentation, because now we can ask our questions. I want to start off, I just have a couple of things that I would first of all to say. It's very nice to see your financials in an improved situation. However, there are still some concerns. The first thing I would like to refer to, and that is your executive management. You have, according to this report, you've got 4 out of 6 of your executive management are acting. Can we have some comment on that? When you expect to have that position rectified? And then I would like to move on to the independent auditor's report on page 47. And the emphasis of matter, without qualifying our opinion, we draw attention to paragraph 15 in the director's report, which indicates that although the company has sufficient cash resources to meet its operating cash requirements for the foreseeable future, there is significant doubt about the ability of the company to continue as a going concern in the longer term without the commencement of sustainable mining activities. Now, the chairman referred to this in his report. It was referred to again in the slide today. Those concerns, we seem to be okay until March 2012. Can we have, you know, Alex Core is actually very important to us because it provides jobs in a community, and it is an entity that is able to do that, and it's able to grow that. So it's extremely important that we don't find us waking up here in another year's time and we haven't picked up that something has gone awry as far as the funding goes. So if we can have some idea of how you are going to be moving forward on that. Then I would like to just go to the page at the back of your book, page 96. I want to just refer here to the director's remuneration. I see that M. Mpanza, the mine engineer, seems to have had quite a big increase. What would be the explanation for that? From 520.3 to 8 to 862. We can have some idea as to why there's such a big leap over there. And then just also Dr. Makin also seems to have gone from 142,000 to 209, also a relatively quite a big jump. And C. Tal, if we could have some explanation about those leaps in remuneration, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Khololo.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me also thank the presentation from the CEO. and the team. I've got a few comments and a question for clarity. Let me also welcome the pooling and sharing joint venture. I know they were looking for the strategic partner. Finally, they got it. We're happy. On the health and safety, your fatality-free production shifts is very, very impressive, I must say. We need to commend you for that. I'll give you 9 out of 10.
1 out of 10.
10. Yeah. It's difficult to give the total, actually. That is for the closing the year under review at 1,885. And subsequently achieving the next milestone of 2000. Very good. And then question on the new diamond opportunities. In that you've been granted a mandate to pursue other diamond mining and related opportunities outside the Alexander Bay. In order to expand your footprint. In fact, I just want to ask if are you not contemplating or considering buying a stake in the sale of the DPS? You heard that they are selling their, what you call, instead of allowing the Anglo-American actually to take everything, So I'm not thinking of that. I think it would be a good idea for yourself to do that. The second one, Chair, will be on the aging mining fleet. In that, you know, I remember you used to complain about the aging equipment and the fleet, which is adversely affecting your production output. How do you plan to improve this kind of a scenario? This aging fleet and so on. Thank you very much.
Honorable Mokwena.
Yeah, Chairperson. Yeah, we definitely welcome the report. just a few quick questions. Alexco is a diamond mining company. And what has always bothered me is not just actually a suspicion, but just some worry why your balance sheet has been so weak. Don't you think there was pilfering and also wrongdoings there? Because, I mean, diamonds are very expensive. And you should really be presenting a very struggling balance sheet, reflecting very, very low profits. I'm one of those few who were privileged to serve on this portfolio committee in the first parliament. And that has always worried me, that Alesco has really been, I wouldn't say under-declaring, under-reporting, because I don't want to cast aspersions, but I just get worried that the precious metal fetches very, very high profit prices on the market, and you should really be notching very high profits. So that really worries me. That's number one. Number two, as my colleagues have said, we welcome the PSJV, as long overdue. We're glad that all the legal agreements are behind us now, and that you're going to be more focused. Linked to that, Chairperson, is my question. In order to broaden your footprint, carry out your expansionist program with the 51%, of course, don't you require any legislative adjustment from our side in respect of the Alexco Act in order to enable you to fly easily without constraints, because the original mandate possibly might not have foreseen that you'd go beyond the next bay, Alexander Bay, we're operating. Number three, I assume that you have shortchanged yourself, paying $42 million to fund the establishment of the municipality in Alexander Bay. Well, in fact, National Treasury has made available $845 billion for infrastructural development,
why didn't you tap into that money in order to save yourself saving this money? Because government is not supposed to operate in silos. We've got this huge amount of $845 billion for infrastructural development in our country. And township development of that municipality there qualifies for access of that money. So you didn't have to spend that money out of your own pocket. That could have strengthened your balance sheet better. And I don't think it's too late. I think you must still find ways of finding out. The DP will help you to find out if you can still take advantage of that. Now, the other point is this. The Orange River is a very long river, and there are alluvial diamonds there. And I wonder, Chairperson, if Alexco, in terms of its operations, is not part of that whole extent, because those alluvial diamonds, I mean, who is accessing them? This would obviously fall under the jurisdiction of Alexco, and that should be a lot of diamonds. And who is policing that? Who's monitoring all that? And finally, when you expand into Africa and beyond, don't you consider strategically taking your community representatives as your JV partners in order to enhance your credibility, that when you go to those countries there, you don't just go there as one of the vulture corporates, but you can actually say, here's a model of a JV at home, so when you get you to a country, we will be able to implement this JV model in order to get more acceptability there. That does not mean you go with the PSJV into those countries, but you show them that at home we are geared in terms of empowerment, et cetera, and to develop people, so that they can see you in a better light, and that might make it easy for you to get inroads into those countries and have less competition. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Somtu.
Chair, thank you very much. Let me join my colleagues in applauding Alexco, who has posted an operating profit this time around. But there are matters that we would want to understand in the process, especially in the process of you making yourselves a new entity or a new business, as you are saying. One would want to know who is involved in the process of you applying the turnaround strategy for you to be a business. How involved is PRC in that process? And as much as auditors have not given you a qualification, which is good, there are matters that auditors have raised. Now, one would want to understand, given the fact that now you have an acting CEO, a new board, some of the new board members and all that, how are you going to try to rectify the matters that have been raised by the auditors? You have also raised the fact that there are some constraints that you are facing, constraints and challenges. One would want to understand, given the fact that now you have formulated yourself into a PSJV, working with that community, what type of improvement do you foresee for yourselves and for that
particular community. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Honorable von Dahlen.
Yes, thank you. I would like to know, say, on page 90, I see there's a decrease in the royalties that you have paid. Although you have reported the increase in the profits and the increase in the carats, so you are paying less royalties. It's from 6.2 million down to 2.2 million. Why would that be? I would think that if you take out more diamonds, you would pay more royalties. I mean, that would just make logical sense. Maybe there's a good answer for it. You know, and then I hear that the acting mine manager, Mr. Bassoni, has resigned. And I also wanted to know, why is his salary reflected under deed of settlement? And is he also a contractor, like you are, running the state-owned enterprise? And then Mr. Latagan and Mr. Mazururi at the announcement... No, Mr. Latagan is the contractor, yeah. And then at the announcement of the annual report, you have said that, and I want to latch on to what my colleagues have said, that you were going into Africa and the DRC, you know, and the DRC, when I think of the DRC, I think of blood diamonds and everything else. I know of people that have had coups there and had lots of problems. They lost a lot of money investing in those countries, so... Why would we even, as a state-owned enterprise from South Africa, which have our own diamonds, would go into other countries? And then I see Mr. Diergaard, I saw him last time on television, he was saying he made enough money to retire. And I see him, yes, I would like to know what his involvement at Alex Core is at the moment. He was very flamboyant when I saw him on TV, you know? And now he's very quiet. I thought he would say something today, you know. And then I also read in the media that the mine was closed due to health risks and hazards, and that the mine doctor is not there, it's too far away, and the equipment are of so a standard that it can't be used, it's falling apart, and that you don't have contracts with your contractors. I hope yours is in place, Mr. Latagan. You have a signed contract with Alex Corp. Not like the rest of the 50 that don't have any side contracts. Thank you very much. Maybe you can answer us on these.
Thank you so much. Just from my side, just one or two issues. I link up to the question asked by Honorable Sontu. As you didn't get a qualified audit opinion, but you did receive emphasis of matter. And if you look carefully at the emphasis of matter, it's quite material. It's quite substantial because the performance information was deficient, no consistency. The plan targets were not specific, measurable, time-bound, and well-defined, which is a basic requirement from National Treasury. There were changes to the objectives which were not approved. And then at the time of your submitting of your annual report, the directors did not conclude the shareholders agreement. Can you just inform this committee on what measures have, what progress have you made so far with the independent auditor's opinion? Secondly, do you have any outstanding issue that is flowing from this annual report? Your upgrading of your residential area in Alexander Bay, is it outstanding? There were historically some disagreements. Has that been settled? And then the chairperson of the board, you were quoted in the newspaper. Well, let me start. You say you have a new mandate, an authority for new mining ventures. And you have the permission from the shareholder to go out and seek new opportunities, new ventures. And then you were quoted in the media recently to say you need between 200 and 250 million rand. Can you inform the committee where you will get that money from? You said you talked to the shareholders and they didn't tell you to go and jump in a lake. But just inform us where will that funding come from? And just lastly, what How can you, if we summarize your annual report, what is your biggest challenge flowing from this annual report that you table before the committee today? Thank you. Over to you for reply.
Thank you, Chairman. I'll tackle a few of the issues and I'll also then call upon my colleagues to assist me where we so require. If we perhaps just tackle the first issue, which was raised by Honourable Bowman, which is the issue of the executive management and the acting scenarios. I think if you will remember, we've been through a process where from 2007 the deed of settlement was reached and agreed. We then had to go through a process of fulfilling certain conditions precedent before the PSJV could be established. Part of that process then precluded us from making any permanent appointments pursuant to the pooling and sharing joint venture being established, because following the establishment of the pooling and sharing joint venture, the joint board of the PSJV, which would incorporate Alex Kaur and the community, would need to make those appointments. I'm happy to report that since the 4th of April, quite a number of those positions are being resolved. The mine manager, Mr. Mike Mpanza, is now appointed as a permanent staff. We have an HR manager who is also in place, Mr. Melvin Duckett, and we recently appointed a security officer. We are still in the market looking for a mineral resources manager. We haven't identified the candidate, but we now need them to come through to the mine and look at the conditions and confirm that this particular candidate will be happy to be resident out there. As you know, it is quite a remote location and doesn't suit everybody's taste, so that is something that we always do with candidates when we get to that stage. And similarly, we are currently in the process of doing our normal occupational health and safety checks and that sort of thing with the financial manager that will be also resident on site. In terms of perhaps preempting a later question that was asked, indeed, as part of the transition period that we went through, Mr. Vian Basson has been appointed and is the contractor that acts or that has acted up to now in the position of mine manager. Given the change that has happened, we have promoted him to general manager of the operations, because effectively now the CEO of Alex Kaur no longer has jurisdiction over the day-to-day activities at the PSJV, and in fact Vian Basson now assumes that role that is more encompassing in terms of running and implementing the strategic direction of the pooling and sharing joint venture board. He reports into the PSJV board, and that PSJV board, in terms of the Alex Kaur representatives, then reports into the Alex Kaur board. The team that now resides at Alex Kaur in terms of the corporate entity is now solely tasked with looking at the new activities and opportunities, as well as addressing the historical liabilities and obligations that that we have as such. We are in discussion with Mr. Basson, because as a contractor, he does have other areas that he would like to get into at some point, but we, in terms of the transition period that we have his commitment that he is around until such a time as we are able to put in a more substantive appointment in terms of the general manager role. So at this point in time, up to our year end, we do not anticipate any issues in that regard, but we do know that we'll need to do a transition, and that's something that we also need to look at in terms of our succession planning process to see whether we have a candidate that could step into that role. Mike Mpanza is an example, but we believe we may have to do some further training, etc., with Mike before he can fulfill that role. So that is something that the board is looking at and will make a determination at. And the board that is looking at is the PSJV board, which obviously now has a jurisdictional responsibility over the day-to-day operations of the activities at Alexander Bay. In terms of then looking at the independent auditor's report and the issue around the emphasis of matter and the issue of going concern, and looking at that going concern issue specifically, the issue is obviously that for Alex Kaur going forward, we now do not have a revenue stream because our business is handed over to the pooling and sharing joint venture.
We anticipate that over the next 2 to 3 years, we are going to be undertaking significant exploration, because some of you may recollect, and Honorable Mokoena, perhaps you recollect, that the last time that proper exploration was done at Alexco was in 1998. Obviously, with the uncertainties that were introduced into Alexco as an operation with the land claim settlement process that commenced in 1998, there was not significant investment made into Alexco, into Alexco's equipment or into its exploration, because there was uncertainty as to how that whole process would be resolved. Furthermore, with then in 2007, the formal deed of settlement agreement being put in place, Alexco was directed to stop all land mining activities. We then had a subsequent agreement with the community, because in order to maintain some of the equipment, etc., we needed some revenues to keep turning it over, and we are in harsh environmental conditions where if equipment stops running, the sand clogs it up and then you can't use it. So as part of that agreement, the community at the time kindly agreed that Alexco could undertake minimal sweeping tailings and working of previously mined dumps, which is the minimal activity that we have been doing in terms of the land mining. Obviously, because the marine side was not impacted in terms of the land claim process, we could continue full steam ahead in terms of the marine. But on the marine side, I think as we've reported on a number of occasions, we are impacted significantly by weather. As an example, we went through about a week where we had floods that effectively took out 4 or 5 of what would have been sea days for us in the March 2011 year, because of the excessive flooding that happened in December of last year. But despite that, with the good work that our technical teams have been doing, we still managed to exceed our our budgets in terms of budgeted carat production. So even with all those constraints, I believe that we have managed in the past year, and certainly a lot of that has been due to the good work that Vian, as a technical person in his capacity as mine manager, has helped us to look at new ways of operating, and within the constraints that we had, has significantly helped us to increase our productive capacity, and that's something that we believe we can continue into this year. We are.
Who monitors your marine operations?
I'm not quite sure what. In terms of regulatory authority or...
No, superintending, making sure that then your ships go to the sea and then they get the dam ones and verification, etc., etc.
We have an on-site management team that looks after the marine operations, and obviously that is something that we look at. Remember, when they go out, they also go out and get gravel, and that gravel we then process within our plants is Alexco as such. You know, one can say that if they happen to find a stone, there is some risk that it may not come through into the product that is declared, but in essence they are dealing in dark conditions, etc., and they're using suction pumps that pull out gravel, and that gravel gets processed. So with the security measures and other things that we have in place, and we're constantly reviewing it and putting in place better measures as we go through, we believe that we are capturing the bulk of the diamonds that come through. Incidentally, we have appointed a deep sea contractor who will be commencing with surveying and exploration at the end of this month, and on that particular vessel, as they proceed, we will have two of our security and Alexco personnel on board supervising the processes to make sure that our security measures are in place and being adhered to, and that we actually get all the diamonds that come through. In terms of the shallow water and deep water processes, obviously they are within line of sight given the distances that they go, and we have security that is within the Alexco harbour that monitor the movement of those boats, etc. Obviously, if someone has a submarine or something, that is difficult to monitor. But in terms of the day-to-day operations, we believe that we have sufficient control measures in place. Moving on, then, if I may, to the issue of the director's remuneration, starting with Mr. Mpanzo, the mine engineer. The salary that is reflected in the previous year was for a portion of the year because he was appointed partway through the year, and obviously in the current year we would then have the full salary being reflected. He was appointed for 7 or 8 months in the previous year, and obviously in the current year his 12 months would be shown. The change in Professor Macken's package is that during the year she was she became the chairperson of the Remuneration Committee, and obviously chairpersons of committees have slightly higher remuneration than ordinary members. And secondly, as part of the integration process with us looking towards getting the PSJV on board, she was also appointed as a member and was also chairperson of the Remuneration Committee of the Pooling and Sharing Joint Venture. Moving on then to the questions by Honorable Hololo. With Claude Powell, he was appointed to the Audit Committee, which was an additional portfolio that he then held. And also, he sits and serves as chairperson of the Tender Committee. And because of the number of tender appointments we had to do in terms of completing the township establishment process, there were a few more meetings on the Tender Committee than the year before. Just wanted to get acknowledgement that we've addressed the issues raised by Honorable Bowman. Okay. Moving on then, in terms of the new diamond mining initiatives, maybe I don't know if I should call on Mr. Kamungwama to address that specific one.
Just to talk about the new strategic mandate that's been given to AlexCo. As the honourable members will have heard, AlexCo has a number of liabilities on its books that actually need to be addressed, and the biggest one is the environmental rehabilitation at Alexander Bay, which some of that degradation actually predates the incorporation of AlexCo. But in terms of the deed of settlement that was signed with the Richards community, AlexCo remains responsible for the rehabilitation of all the degradation at Alexander Bay. And in this regard, and also in line with what was agreed in the deed of settlement with the Richards Hill community, there was a revision of the environmental management plan that had to be agreed with the Department of Mineral Resources, and that set out a plan to rehabilitate the mine there. So there are commitments that every year there should be some level of work that needs to be done to rehabilitate the rehabilitate the area. So effectively, that requires the company to have some revenue streams to actually address those liabilities. The other one is the post-retirement liability that the chairperson referred to. That liability has been restructured and capped. And in terms of that, the company needs to make fixed payment per year over a 5-year period to address that particular liability. So effectively, the company needs to be in a position to generate revenues to enable it to address those liabilities. Currently, given that the pooling and sharing joint venture has come into effect and has taken over all the operations at Alexander Bay, the only source of revenue would be the income from the profit share, that 51% share in the profit from the PSJV. We know that given the focus of the PSJV, that we don't expect any profits from the PSJV for the next 3 years, and this is because even as much as and this is in line with the deed of settlement, the PSJV has been capitalized to the amount of 200 million, as the members will be aware. The PSJV is now embarking on an extensive exploration program to come up with an effective mine development plan for Alexander Bay area, both marine and land operations. So effectively, for the first 3 years, we anticipate that there will be no profits flowing from the PSJV, and consequently no income coming into Alexco. But Alexco remains encumbered with these liabilities that need to be addressed with actual cash flows. So in line with that, the mandate has been given to Alexco to look at procuring new mining ventures that will generate revenue streams for them to address these liabilities. So in that regard, they will be looking beyond Alexander Bay within South Africa, and also in line with the new growth path, looking at the regional opportunities that are able to generate income streams at the earliest stage, because Alexco does need very early income streams. So in line with that, Alexco will be pursuing those opportunities. Aside from that, and in line with the new growth path, they will also be looking at beneficiation opportunities. So they're looking at how to add value to the diamonds, which would entail looking at opportunities for cutting and polishing to add value to the products that they mine, and hopefully that will put them on a more sustainable path. Effectively, that's where that new mandate is coming from, and I think the question was raised whether there has been engagement with the PRC around that, and just to address that question, you will know that there's another state mining company that has been established, Africa Exploration Mining and Finance Company. And we have been engaging with the Department of Mineral Resources as well as the PRC, exploring synergies between the two companies and see how the two will work in relation to each other. Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony. I think one part that still needs to be answered is the whole issue of the De Beers stake.
The members will be aware of that there had been an agreement between the then Department of Minerals and Energy with De Beers in relation to the Namaqualand mine of De Beers at Klenze. That is under the realm of the DMR, and it remains on the table as to the Alexco's participation in that, and we're still actively engaging on how that can come into the Alexco stable. At this point, we haven't come to any conclusion, but in terms of that agreement, 20% of Namaqualand mine at Klenze would be a 20% stake would be transferred to government. So effectively, it's just the identity of where that 20% stake then resides. But given the disinvestment of De Beers in many concessions around the country, that does not preclude AlexCorp looking at some of those mining opportunities where it can. And as you're aware, I think the main issue with De Beers is that they've got very high overheads because of their head office costs. So their cost of mining is on the higher side, and as you'll have seen, De Beers has been disposing of a lot of their older mines to juniors who are able to mine at a lower cost. So even in terms of AlexCo, if they're able to get into one of the older De Beers mining ventures and be able to exploit that at a lower cost, that will be an area for worth pursuing. In terms of the legislation, at this point, we don't anticipate that there will be a need for a review, because in terms of the AlexCo Act, it is formed as a diamond company, and the new opportunities that the company is pursuing is in line with that legislation, but we will be looking and just seeing if there are any areas that would need to be beefed up to ensure that AlexCo could operate more effectively.
Thank you for that, Anthony, and I trust that clarifies and addresses the question you had on De Beers.
Suggest you finish all your answers. We'll give a second round, and if there is a follow-up or a new question, then we'll give the opportunity.
Okay, thank you for that. With respect then to the issue of the aging mining fleet, I think as I've said previously, part of the challenge for AlexCo was that we were not in a place to engage in significant capital expenditure whilst there was uncertainty. You'll have seen that in the prior year we spent close to 6 million rand in capital equipment, which was the first step in us starting to prepare for the pooling and sharing joint venture. We, as part of that process, and this year approved a CAPEX budget, Berna, if you can just remind us of the number, of 16 million rand, which is a significant progression towards us picking up on making that necessary investment for us to be able to move forward. Clearly, what is helping us is that we, with the establishment of the PSJV, are now in a position where, aside from the cash flows that are generated by the business itself, are in a position where we can tap into the 200 million rand that Anthony mentioned, which is positioning us for exploration as well as making sure that the mine gets back to as full production as possible, given the resource that we have. Obviously, the exploration activity will give us a firm view of what that is. I would like to link the issue of our CAPEX with the later question that is asked, and specifically around the health and safety issue and the alleged closure of the mine, and just ask Dr. Roger Paul to weigh in on that.
The report that the mine had been closed was due to the Department of Mineral Resources issuing a Section 54 certificate, which related to non-compliance of some of the earth-moving equipment at AlexCo not meeting with the legislation. The paperwork around that Section 54 inquiry was resolved within the matter of one day, and the earth-moving equipment was then returned back into operation. So it was a very short a closure of less than 24 hours, and it was really just to do with some of the paperwork. Regarding the actual medical services which are provided by AlexCo, we have a contract with an independent company called OXA, and they provide a medical doctor on one day a week. There is a resident physician, a private physician on the site, and he is also available to help with any health and safety issues.
And I guess as part of that, the management are reviewing how we can get an additional a doctor that can be on-site to make sure that we have full coverage, particularly in terms of the occupational health and safety issues as we move along. So that is something that is in process. We had envisaged that with the handover of some of the functions that Alexco previously ran itself, the schools, hospital, etc., that the Northern Cape province would step in and would provide some of that medical profession as required, but that at this point has not happened. It is an engagement that we're also continuing with the Northern Cape Provincial Government, but as a matter of making sure that we have cover for our own staff at the mine, we are re-looking at and putting in place the necessary provisions. To then move on to the questions that were asked by Honorable Mokwena, starting with the question of why Alexco has such a weak balance sheet. Certainly since 2007, Alexco has been precluded from undertaking any land mining activities. So from that perspective, none of those diamonds have been mined or could be mined as a condition of preserving some of that value for the community. So all the production that we've seen to date has been largely between 75% to 80% coming out of production from the marine side. And the marine production, given that we have experience with the changing environmental patterns, fewer sea days than we're accustomed to, is reasonably consistent with where we would expect production to be. So from our perspective, we don't see anything that is highly problematic in terms of that side. What we have looked at is that historically we've concentrated our production around the north of the mine where we get the bigger and the more valuable stones, but as part of this process of now moving towards full production in the course of 2009 and going into 2010, we embarked on, because quite a lot of our contracts were coming to an end, we went through a fairly extensive new tender process, which resulted in the appointment of 50 new contractors. And obviously, as we went through that process, there were discussions and debates with those contractors around terms and conditions in their contracts. We have now had all those contracts signed. So, you know, I think sometimes parties like to fan things that are actually not quite correct. And I think in this case, the contractors were out of order to run out and say that their contracts were not signed when, in fact, we're going through a process of clarifying what those agreements were and what the terms and conditions of those agreements were. And we did, in fact, for the current contractors, allow them to continue mining on in terms of the terms and conditions of the previous contracts until, obviously, we had the new contracts in place. That has now actually been put in place, and I think hopefully things have settled down in terms of that component.
Chair, a follow-up to clear my confusion. Alexco has been precluded from mining on the land, yet you are going to rehabilitate as a historical liability. Why should you take that liability, which is not yours?
The environmental liability that we're talking about is the pre-existing liability. So part of the process is going to be that as the PSJV reviews areas that it is going to mine, components of that liability possibly may be extinguished because they will now be re-mined because it's an area that happens to be prospective. However, based on the initial work that's done, the majority of the areas that do need to be rehabilitated are areas that are essentially mined out and therefore would have to be rehabilitated as a matter of course. So pursuant to obviously the court order arising from the deed of settlement, Alexco has that obligation to rehabilitate that old environmental and pre-existing environmental liability. In terms of new environmental liability that now becomes an issue in terms of the new mining activity, that then becomes effectively a PSJV responsibility. And part of the mechanism that we are looking at is
now that we have all this experience is that our mining methods will more likely be along the lines of, as we mine, we'll rehabilitate and we'll not leave areas with dumps, etc., that are unresolved. So as we finish a section, those sections will then be rehabilitated as we go along. And whether we do that directly in sections where the PSJV itself is mining, or where we allow contractors to come in and work with us to help us with capacity constraints that may be in place, those obligations will be passed on to make sure that we don't effectively build up new liability in the PSJV, but rather that we resolve those activities as we move along.
I would also like to bring to the attention of the honourable members that diamond mining at Alexander Bay has taken place almost unbroken for more than 80 years. During the peak of production, during the 1960s, Alex Corp was producing more than 1 million carats of diamonds per year. It now produces 35,000. And largely all the high-grade resources over those 80 years have been completely mined out. So right now we are mining what is left behind, the low-grade diamond reserves and resources, and the amount of material that we have to move to get the low-grade